I don't know what the equivalent of that would be. My brain isn't fully fired up yet to come up with the crushing analogy, but we may by the end of the show. We begin, though, in hideous waters. We return to hideous waters with a question that is actually very important. The professionals who failed the victims of the Southport murderer, should they run the risk of being named and shamed?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. The Chancellor is due to meet her US counterpart in Washington, despite being at odds over the war with Iran. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says a small bit of economic pain is worth stopping Tehran from having nuclear weapons. But Rachel Reeves says she's frustrated by America's lack of an exit plan. US Vice President J.D. Vance told a rally in the US that Donald Trump is holding out for a grand bargain.
And what he's basically offering to Iran is very simple, and frankly, it's something that no president has, I think, has had the ability to offer. He said that if you're willing to act like a normal country, we are willing to treat you economically like a normal country. He doesn't want a small deal.
The Chief Secretary to the Treasury has told LBC the defense investment plan will be published as soon as possible. It follows major criticism from a former head of NATO who's warned a lack of spending has put the UK in peril. Ministers insist defense spending's increasing each year. Another two men have been charged with murder after the death of a 21-year-old student in North London. Finbar Sullivan died after he was attacked on Primrose Hill last Tuesday. The two 25-year-olds will appear in court later. MPs will vote for a second time on whether to ban under-16s from social media. The Prime Minister is under pressure to back a Lords amendment made to the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill. A government consultation is due to run until the end of next month. Conservative peer and former Education Minister Lord Nash has told LBC this needs swifter action.
The government acted really quite decisively on pornography. They acted decisively on nudification apps. And all I'm saying to them is, particularly now, following these game-changing US cases where some pretty shocking material was disclosed by the social media companies and to have deliberately designed addictive apps. These are game changers, and the Prime Minister has said that and that he will now act.
And a watchdog has fined two driving schools owned by the AA more than £4 million for what's known as drip pricing. The Competition and Markets Authority says the firms had not included a mandatory booking fee in their upfront prices. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 4 points at 10,614. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, an unsettled and windy day for many. Rain moving eastward through the UK with a high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm David Dom.
British Gas have this thing. We call it home care. We'll fix all sorts, and it's unlimited repairs. Expert engineers will solve the upset of boilers not boiling or taps that won't wet. Electrics playing tricks or a pipe that's broke. We're there for everyone, even blue furry folk. Your home won't feel booby-trapped. It'll feel just like new. British Gas, taking care of things and looking after you. T's and C's apply. Excess options available per repair.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. It's 3 minutes after ten, and I'm conscious sometimes of starting off. I don't go off on a tangent. I start the show on a tangent and then have to sort of steer it back to what we want to talk about subsequently, and that can be a little bit distracting. In fact, I've literally just done it, haven't I? I've gone off on a tangent. You've got no idea what we're talking about yet, and I've gone off on a tangent about what I normally do at the top of the show, but I promise you this is relevant. I saw two members of staff, I suppose you'd call them. I don't know whether they were specific security guards normal shop assistants. I think they had a specific responsibility for being security guards. But I was in Marks and Spencer's yesterday. I know I am a walking middle-class cliche, but frankly, their raspberry puddings cannot be improved upon by man or beast. I was in Marks and Spencer's yesterday, and I saw two lads grab, if you like, catch a shoplifter. And it really struck me. it really struck me that you don't see that much very often. And in fact, I've shared stories with you from the same branch of Marks and Spencer's about the impunity with which some people with baskets full of goods would waltz out of the shop. But I mention this because it's really hard and it's really physical. And I think armchair store detectives like me and everybody else who does what I do for a living, whether in print or on air, and of course in the comment sections of every media organisation under the sun, completely underestimate how bloody hard it is. Because you're talking about someone who is likely to get immediately and very violent. And this chap did. And the two lads that were containing him needed to be very, very fit for purpose. I'm not casting aspersions on anybody, but I've seen people in uniform at the doors of supermarkets who would have been flat on their back within a nanosecond if the person that these two lads were catching had been the one that they were trying to stop. So it made me realise that when you wonder why so much crime of that nature goes unchallenged, it's actually a really easy question to answer. Unless, in this case, the store is prepared both to prioritise and pay people to take fairly immense physical risk, then the alternative is to let the steam puddings walk out of the door unmolested and leave your staff safe. So, fair play to whoever has made the decision at Marks and Spencer's, whether it's a board level or a management level or whether it was just the Chiswick High Road branch. And huge kudos to the two young men who I kind of watched a bit because I walked past one of them and he was on his radio and I followed events and they were tracking this guy and he was making his way. And then they just pounced and he sort of started struggling quite violently and they held him and they carried him into the back of the store. And it made me feel embarrassed about the blasé nature with which I have discussed these things. It made me feel a little bit embarrassed about the way in which we talk about this stuff as if, you know, someone is easily to blame and someone is easily identifiable and we do their job much better than they would and we know that they're at fault and we know that they should be held accountable for it and why aren't they doing this anyway? It was really hard. I don't know how often you encounter physical violence or at least, you know, high level physical exertion between human beings, but it is always, unless, and if I am now describing you, I pity you. I really do. I'm so sorry for the fact that you have ceased to be traumatized in any way, shape or form by physical violence. It should traumatise us. And that's just spectators. You see it. It's not rubbernecking. It's like a sense of shock. It's an atavistic, visceral, oh, my Lord. Oh, that's so out of the ordinary. My heart's going like that. And there's, you know, a couple of little old ladies in the foyer of the shop, and they are deeply disturbed by what they are seeing, and people don't know what to do. They're thinking, do I object? Are they being too rough with the guy? But he's a thief, and So I'm sorry that I have talked about these things in a fashion that makes everything sound easy. And next time we turn our attention to low-level crime, or indeed the sheer difficulty of doing what journalists, and I wish I could say tabloid journalists with the usual sneer that I deploy at this point, but I don't consider myself to be in that category, and I have done it. So next time we turn our attention to that, we will do better. We will do better. And for reasons that I hope are clear, I found myself thinking about that this morning when I read about the calls for officials who failed failed over the Southport attack to be held to account. Families in Southport cannot be sure that officials who made catastrophic errors before the murder of three girls are not still making the same mistakes, a former victims commissioner has said, suggesting that they should be held to account by name. This is Vera Baird, King's Counsel, pointing out that those who failed to properly monitor the killer should not be able to shrug it off. She said, it really is time for personal accountability. We have tragic failures many times followed by public inquiries, but nobody actually has to stop doing what they're doing badly. I do not see why that should be the case. Except, of course, it's not necessarily the case, because there was one very infamous incident in the years that I've been doing this job where I think Ed Balls, as children's minister, called for the head
of a head of children's services in Haringey Council, and she was subsequently fired. And she subsequently won, I think, over £500,000 in compensation for unfair dismissal. So that urge, that almost metaphorical bloodlust for vengeance for somebody to be held accountable doesn't. I mean, it does happen. A story that I presume the former victims commissioner has forgotten about, but it doesn't necessarily deliver justice. And then you turn to the lawyer, or one of the lawyers, for the three families caught up in this hideous story. And the threat there is, I think, even more acute. There is a doctor already named who is on the record 2 years before the Southport attacks, describing AR as posing a minimal risk to others. We know that he had not read the notes in full, so he was unaware of key parts of the man, the boy's history. He told the public inquiry, this is the only reason why we know his name, that there had been a sort of blind spot on his part, but he denied failing in his duty, claiming it was impossible to read every aspect, and instead blaming the father for not telling him of previous violence. Sir Adrian Fulford, who, as you know, has presided over this report into the preventability of the July 2024 attacks that left BB King, Alistair Silva, Aguirre and Elsie Dot Stancombe dead, other children injured, and everybody within the environs of this hideous crime deeply traumatised, in some cases presumably forever. We know that he has emphasised that psychiatrists and many other professionals acted in good faith in their dealings with the teenager, but the report also lays bare many, many missed opportunities. This is what yesterday's phone-in was about. Medical professionals, social care professionals, authority figures, police professionals who did not ask the right questions, did not share the relevant information, and focused more on the killer's, the future killer's welfare than they did on the risk that he posed to others. And now we come to the crux of our conversation this morning. The families of the victims, BB King, I don't think we can say their names often enough, to be honest with you, and I entirely approve of attempts to keep the name of the killer off our lips. BB King, Elsie Dot Stancombe and Alice Da Silva Aguirre. They want transparency and accountability. Their lawyer, their solicitor, Chris Walker, has vowed to name professionals from five institutions who failed to stop the killer if disciplinary actions are not taken. And I want to know what you think about that, because their jobs, and you see now why I began the program with a memory of encountering a shoplifter being caught, and carried through to the back of the store in West London yesterday. Their jobs are really hard. Their jobs are really hard. And if you messed up, you run the risk of being on the front page of the Sun newspaper under this reading of the situation. You run a very real risk of having your picture, yeah, a picture of your hammy. You know how the newspapers work, right? And the due process that is in place, the idea that you can retrospectively make any of this better, it has an air of vengeance to it. And I don't know what you felt yesterday. I don't know how you respond to stories like this, because I think it's a combination of two things. Your blood boils and your heart sinks. And some people seem to be 100% boiling blood, and that would be what we might describe as the Hang'em and Flog'em Brigade. And some people seem to be 100% heart sinks, and that would be what we might describe as the do-gooder. So it's a slightly odd phrase, that, because it sort of demonises, doesn't it, the idea of doing good. But do you know what I mean? The sort of person perceived as being far too empathetic and far too compassionate. And that's a thing. That's a thing in this case. Make no mistake, if Sir Adrian Fulford has found that professionals acting in good faith fatally, and I can use that word, sadly, prioritise the welfare of the future killer over the safety of people he would come into contact with in the future. So there is a sort of surfeit, if you like, of sympathy. So I think all of us respond with a combination of boiling blood and sinking heart. But where those percentages divide is going to be different for almost all of us. And the more boiling blood you are, the easier it is this morning to call for the names of the professionals responsible, the professionals identified, to be named and shamed. But the other thing I mentioned to you yesterday that didn't immediately seem relevant, but I hope was the inquiry announced in our news bulletin at 10 o'clock, just before I came on air, into the killing of Ian Huntley in jail, and the idea that nobody with a scintilla of good sense would object to an inquiry into the killings of these three girls, but most people probably don't really care about having an inquiry into the killing of Ian Huntley. And that's the perfect example of what I'm trying to describe to you, because the law cannot take into account boiling blood or sinking heart. The law must look only and exclusively at the law, which means that Ian Huntley, in death, has as much right to an inquiry into how he was killed as B.B. King, Alice de Silva Aguirre and Elsie Dott Stancombe do. And it feels wrong, right? It feels a bit wrong, because words never reach where feelings can go. Words can say, oh, you must obey the letter, but that's why we have judges. It's why families don't decide sentences. It's why victims don't deliver verdicts. It's why we have lawyers, judges, and juries in this country for now, in the latter case, in the final case. And I really want to get that clear in your mind, because I don't sit here in judgment on people baying for metaphorical blood. I sit here in judgment on racists trying to treat the negligent and deeply responsible parents differently from how they would if they were white or if they were born here, because that's just racism and that's honest Bob Jenrick's bag now. Although he's not quite as slimy at it, is he, as his boss? His boss has spent his entire life essentially knowing exactly where the boundaries are, exactly what you can whisper into the ears of Jewish contemporaries at your school as long as the teachers don't hear. To watch honest Bob Jenrick trying to do it, so clumsily and so unpleasantly, is a particularly hideous spectacle that we will say no more about. But the professionals involved, the baying for their blood, is an entirely understandable and probably reasonable position. Because however much your blood boils or your heart sinks, the idea of discovering that it could have been prevented and nothing happening to the people who could have prevented it is, I mean, it's almost unconscionable, isn't it? But is it fair? Is it fair? 0345 6060973. If you work in the sector and you have made mistakes, then in a different set of circumstances, perhaps those mistakes could have caused tragedy, could have caused horror. Anybody who tells you that they've been doing a job for a significant period of time and has never made a mistake is either a liar or Donald Trump. Actually, that's tautology, isn't it? They are a liar. We all make mistakes, some big, some small. Sometimes small mistakes cause massive ructions, and sometimes big mistakes go almost unnoticed, depending upon variables and moments and events. But if you have gone into these kind of professions, if you have gone into the police force, the medical professions, the social care professions, should you, when the worst happens, run the risk of being stuck in the stocks, essentially exposed to abuse in the town square, pilloried? These are medieval practices, you know, the pillory, the stocks, the scold's bridle. You literally invite public approbation. You literally invite public abuse of people perceived to have transgressed. And it goes far beyond the legal system. It goes far beyond, particularly with our feral media. It goes far beyond any system of justice. And it delivers something else. And I'm not quite sure what it delivers. For the avoidance of doubt, there's a large part of me that thinks if this is what the parents want, this is what the parents should get. I want to make that absolutely clear. But as I say those words, I hope I've already created an echo in your mind of the observation that the victims and the families of victims don't get to decide what the law is or what the or what justice looks like. And they can't. That way, anarchy lies. So, knowing what you know, particularly, and I know nothing about these jobs. That's why I started the programme today talking about shoplifters and store detectives. But knowing what you know, or like me, knowing nothing, but simply having a functioning brain and a bit of a conscience and a sense of intellectual or philosophical curiosity, do you think that these people should be named and shamed if the lawyer and the families of the poor girls killed are unsatisfied by due process, if their system doesn't deliver enough sense of justice or vengeance or something else, then should a loud hailer be handed to the solicitor to shout these names from the rooftops? And I honestly, and I'm sorry about this because this is not what you expect from me, I don't know. Because every time my brain kicks in and says, of course not, my heart kicks in and says, what if it was you? But that's the thing you have to shut down, right, in a civilized society. You have to shut down the emotionally driven dimension and focus entirely upon the law. It wouldn't be scapegoating, I don't think, because they are responsible. Their identity is already known to some people, including Sir Adrian Fulford and presumably the solicitor to the families. And some names are already in the public sphere, but only one or two. The only professional publicly known to have been referred for investigation over actions related to the boy is a council social worker. And we know her name. So what if the investigation finds that she couldn't actually have done anything differently? Or that her workload was so immense that it would have been impossible for her to provide the level of care that she wanted to care to every child on her books. Or that the morale in the office or the management structure or her boss hadn't been reappointed after going on maternity leave. Or Osborne's razor had sliced everything so completely that they were incapable of doing a proper job. But they still failed. And her name is now in the public arena, just like Sharon Shoesmith's name is in the public arena, the former head of children's services at Haringey Council, who was in charge when Baby P was murdered by his mother and her boyfriend, and who was dismissed despite arguing that she wanted to keep her job to preside over an investigation into how the hell this could have happened. And her name became mud. Her name was being spat in studios like this with contempt and derision and disgust, and yet it was found at tribunal that she'd been unfairly dismissed, and she walked away with just shy of £700,000 worth of public money, because she had not been treated fairly, and she had not been treated justly. So, that's it, really. Would it be fair to name the professionals and shame the professionals outside of their professional purview? Would it be fair to pin their names on the public notice board and invite the world and his wife to throw abuse at them? Because that, rightly or wrongly, is what would happen. Would it be fair and would it be right? And I'm very, very sorry that I can't answer that question at the moment, because it always makes me feel a tiny little bit uncomfortable about insisting that you do. But I really need you to. 0345 6060 973. It's 10:23.
LBC.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's...
My tip is...
Weight loss?
No, forget that.
You just keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice. Or you could go to MedExpress.
MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest, fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 25 minutes after 10. And before we get stuck into this question, just a quick word on Osborne's razor, because I'm getting some charming messages from charming people politely correcting me. Many of them begin with the words "I love you, James, but," which is obviously the best way to get your criticisms read out on this programme. I'm not making a mistake. I know what Occam's razor is. Osborne's razor is an invention of this programme, and it posits the theory that many, many of the problems, if not close to all of the problems in our society that we discuss on a daily basis, will lead in some way back to George Osborne's tenure as Chancellor of the Exchequer, when, for purely ideological reasons, they set fire to society, the safety nets of society. They slashed and burned. They cut all of the things that keep us civilized and keep us safe, because they wanted to, and it would have reduced the tax bills of their donors and their oligarch pals. So Osborne's razor is not a mistake or a slip of the tongue, for goodness sake. Would it be fair to name officials who failed to stop the Southport killer if the families and the lawyer and their lawyer make a subjective decision that the system has not delivered sufficient punishment? Sarah is in Basildon. Sarah, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I think to start with, I'd probably say, as a mother, if someone hurt my child, you'd have to stop me cutting through every single person to get to the person I needed to get revenge.
Yes.
But as a nurse who's worked in public health for a very long time, and who actually has worked through all the stages that you've just spoken about, I can tell you, I think that naming and shaming someone is the top of what is needed. And I don't think you should name and shame. You should name and shame the system that is broken that allowed this, not name and shame the person who works in that broken system.
It's easy to say to, for example, a CAMS team that concluded AR posed no risk to others, not least because he hadn't left the house for 5 months. So you may conclude that someone who's not left the house for 5 months doesn't pose any risk to others. And we are not, I presume you haven't. I know I haven't read all 700 and something pages of this report. Mm-hmm. But this might not be a fair question. Where would the threshold be? I mean, if it turned out that someone was provided with incontrovertible evidence that they knew he was planning to stab somebody, albeit not the three little girls that he ended up murdering, then there is probably, I mean, they'd probably end up on some form of public charge anyway, wouldn't they?
Exactly. So that's what I was thinking, yes. That actually what we need to be better at is we need to be better at using the law to actually charge people. So years ago, there was an issue with a hospital, and it's taken years and years where I saw that there were like corporal manslaughter charges to do with the manager on whatever ward it was, right?
Yes.
I'm not saying that people shouldn't be punished. They should. And also there's accountability to their register, right?
Yes.
Should they be working in that system as a nurse or whatever it is that they're working at? But for someone who works with social workers, mental health nurses, OTs, physios, every person you can think of, I can tell you, I can see so many broken professionals, broken because they've fought hard to try and keep a system working that has been created in the cut to not allow it to work properly.
I mean, how hard is the job?
How do you work amazingly in a system that's broken? I just don't know what people.
I suppose that politicians buy into the idea that they will be named and shamed. Not that it seems to do them any harm, looking at what Chris Grayling has done to the justice system and what George Osborne has done to social care and other areas. But you are working in the knowledge that terrible things are likely to happen, not because of the fickle finger of fate, but because of systemic issues that are fixable by money, with money and goodwill, like poor, and good people.
Yeah, money will. But also, the thing is, everyone. And it doesn't necessarily boil down to money, right? It what it boils down to is stop cutting the money.
Yes.
You can't say the same system. I can tell you right now. I'm not going to say where I work or anything like that.
Oh, okay.
But I've been told I've got to save X amount of million. Right, but I'm still got to provide the same resource. You tell me how I do that. How do I provide the same resource of care, provision? And I work in a very good place, which I love to work in, and it's got very good outcomes, thankfully. But that's because it's run on goodwill and good culture, not of resource and finance.
I hear you. And you know, I'm thinking of Theresa May now and the speech she gave to the Police Federation a few years ago when she called them scaremongers and crying wolf because they had said to her, we can't provide the same level of service today if we are given considerably less money tomorrow. If there are fewer officers on the streets, we cannot do the job as well. And if an officer that subsequently fails or misses something that they may not, you can never prove these things, they're counterfactual, they're 20/20 hindsight, but a better resourced police service may have spotted something sooner and avoided tragedy. And I am thinking of that. What would it be like, briefly, do you think, for a professional to be hauled over the coals in this way, if the solicitor or the families of these girls, of whom I will brook no criticism, and I'm sure you're not minded to give any, but if they just decided they were not satisfied with the process and therefore decided to name a professional from your background, what would that be like for them, do you think?
I think there's two things. One is, I just want to say that even though I'm obviously defensive of the system I work in, I'd also like to say it also allows poor working practice, right? It allows people who are bad to stay in the system.
Yes, I'm sure.
But for that person to be named, what I would say is that there are people who I have known of and worked in trusts where these people have been hunted down, as in named, and their lives are hell.
They were putting bricks through the windows of paediatricians. Practices,
yes,
weren't
they?
20 years ago, because the sort of people that are hanging flags up on roundabouts decided that they needed to take a vengeance on paedophiles, so they started attacking paediatricians. And that's what worries me, actually. I'd forgotten about that. That idea that this would what would it achieve, I wonder? That's a brilliant call, Sarah. You spoil me, actually, with the quality of your insights. It happens almost every day. And my mind goes off then in the other direction of what would it actually achieve if they did name it. I'll tell you what it would achieve. It would make good people considerably less likely to join these professions in case they were ever in the chair when something awful happened, for which they bore quite possibly some responsibility, but responsibility that, as Sarah has highlighted to us, may not be entirely their fault. Blood on your hands is a phrase that pops up when we're talking about people in the context of this case. But what about the politicians that made the decisions to slice the funding and the support for these sort of services? And they were all in that category, you know, social care, medical care and policing. And yet none of them are on the hook for anything. Maybe that's fair. I don't know. 10:33 is the time. David Dom has your headlines.
The Chancellor is to meet her US counterpart in Washington after expressing her anger America went to war without an exit plan. Rachel Reeves says President Trump's folly in Iran means families in the UK are suffering as a result. Two more men have been charged with murder following the death of Finbar Sullivan in North London. The 21-year-old died after being attacked on Primrose Hill last week. And MPs will vote on a social media ban for under-16s for a second time later. The government are still running a separate consultation on it until the end of next month. LBC weather, an unsettled and windy day for many. Rain moving eastward through the UK with a high of 17.
LBC.
Now time to thank our partner on this episode, Sandals Resorts and British Airways Holidays. When we go on holiday, We want a bit of luxury, don't we? We work hard and we want to give ourselves a proper treat. And at Sandals Resorts, that's what you get. Scattered across the Caribbean, you can expect the best beaches, incredible accommodation, up to 16 restaurants per resort, unlimited premium brand drinks and cocktails, loads of activities topped off with sensational sunsets, all included in the price. It's a kind of luxury that means you can fully relax because everything, and it really is everything, is taken care of. You can book all of this through British Airways Holidays with a low deposit and flexible payment plans so you can spread the cost. So, let's go. You're all about the beach life now. To book your dream all-inclusive holiday, and mine to be fair, visit ba.com/sandals. Terms and conditions apply. At all protected.
There comes a time in your life when you need to make a change. To start a new chapter, it's time to consider a residential park home bungalow from Ecos Group. Castleview Court in Pevensey is a peaceful gated community for those aged over 45, set in a stunning location close to all local amenities. You can enjoy a stress-free move with up to 100% part exchange on your existing property with free site fees for your first year. Make that lifestyle change today and join us at our open weekend on the 25th and 26th of April at Castleview Court, Pevensey Bay, Pevensey. Or visit ecosgroup.co.uk. That's E-K-O-S group.co.uk.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy while stocks last.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60973.
10:36 is the time. David makes a point we should address. He says, you're jumping the gun, James. The Girl's solicitor is asking for those responsible to be publicly named only and if the institutions fail to implement appropriate disciplinary action. I don't think I am missing the point, respectfully. But I'm happy to clarify. It's about who gets to decide what's appropriate, mate. And it can't be them, can it? Because, you know, what door does that kick open? It kicks open a door to what James describes in another message as stoning people in the town square in the 20th century. I don't know that I would ever be satisfied with an inquiry into the circumstances that led up to a horror show like this if I was personally involved in it. I don't even know what satisfaction would look like. So the system, for all its flaws and for all its faults, the justice system, maybe, you know, the inquiry system, it cannot be any more than you would allow victims to determine a sentence or a verdict in a court case. It cannot be. I don't believe, I'm coming round to this view after Sarah's call, that they get to make this decision themselves. I just don't quite see what it would achieve. 03456060973 is the number you need to join the conversation. And now to answer that extra question, what would it actually achieve? What positives would it achieve? Because all I can see at the moment is the negative of potential public shaming and a huge deterrent to joining any of these professions that are already creaking under the strain of various pressures. Phil's in Westminster. Phil, what would you like to say?
Morning, James. So my partner, she used to work in children's social care, and she said she had to leave because she felt like she was going mad. She'd start at 7 in the morning.
Yes.
Finish 11 at night, or even sometimes even with serious cases, 1 in the morning. Yeah. And she was being paid for 40 hours a week. She must have been under minimum wage. And the stress and anxiety she was constantly under, just being set up to fail, loaded with cases, and just not being able to go, you know, you have to do it in your own time.
And yeah. Living, I suppose, when you mention stress, in a constant fear of not
24
going
hours.
Home early, going home, yeah. Forgive me, going home on time and not reading a file or not making a call or not doing something that could ultimately lead to a tragedy as hideous as this one.
Yeah, exactly. And it's already, they're having to recruit from outside the UK, but you know, because who wants a job who is set up to fail, working under minimum wage for all those hours, and then might be have their name plastered? Already social workers are targeted on social media, and that's not the, for not doing their job.
Hey, paediatricians got targeted in real life, not even on social media during the, I think it was about 20 years ago. I forget precisely what the moral panic was. It would have had its roots in reality, but the reaction was absolutely insane. And that's, unfortunately, that's what happens in the public space. Insanity.
Yes, I mean, people will target them just for doing their job because they don't want them interfering in their lives.
But you can't shake the sense, you know, and the problem is, you know, I work 3 hours a day and I could sit here if I was assembled slightly differently and start thumping the desk and banging on about how awful it is that they missed this and how awful it is that they missed that. But leaving aside sort of tabloid hyperbole, it is awful that they missed stuff. The question really becomes, was it inevitable?
I mean, obviously, only by looking into in fine detail would you know if a very bad mistake happened. I mean, the social workers have supervisors. They're meant to be supervised. But can the supervisors, they've got to supervise lots of cases, and also they often have their own cases. So they can miss things too. You know, it's people don't realise actually how broken the social care is.
And you come to two of the people who were contributing to the inquiry, and Sir Adrian Fulford found that they were inhibited by the, quotes, unstructured and unhelpful setup of the electronic record of patients, which is about as close to a definition of systemic as you can get, and a failure by previous colleagues in Manchester to do earlier structured risk assessment. So, you know, the idea that you'll be able to, because there's a human appetite for, I don't want to say vengeance, Phil, because vengeance, not everybody finds it a dirty word, but it's not vengeance. There's a human appetite for closure or for
you
completeness.
You need somewhere to aim your pain.
Exactly. But the more you read into
target,
this story,
it's too hurtful for yourself.
Yeah, that's really well put. I shouldn't have talked over you. Say it again.
So you need somewhere to aim your pain. The pain inside yourself is far too much. Yes. So it needs to come out and it needs somewhere to land, and therefore it needs a target.
And that is the danger, of course, of allowing the decision to be taken outside of due process, outside of the practice. And the unfairness is upon people like your partner is immeasurable. Along a similar theme, Paul writes, my view on naming and shaming is that it would be entirely counterproductive. Child mental health is already a profession into which it's incredibly hard to recruit. We have a massive shortage of trained staff, and if this were to come to pass, I think people would actually leave in large numbers. So it's not just becoming a deterrent for people joining in the future, it's a catalyst for people leaving in the moment. Child mental health is undervalued and the consequences of failure are extreme, as this tragic case highlights. Where gross negligence occurs, then fine, criminal sanctions are appropriate and already an option. But victims or their families just being allowed to put out names and identities into the public domain on their own volition, regardless of proven culpability, is extremely bad for society, and the mass exodus from the profession it will cause would ultimately make us all less safe. It's worth reminding ourselves, of course, that the killer in this case, AR, was not found to have any particular, to have any mental illness, but who was clearly referred to CAMHS because of his conduct. He was diagnosed with autism in 2021, but repeatedly refused to see the assigned psychiatrist, even during scheduled visits to the family home. And again, I hope this is, I don't think this is inappropriate. And if you think it is, I think I'll disagree with you. I'm not going to apologise in case it is. I'm pretty confident this is a valid point to make. Odd though it may seem, when I was watching a shoplifter be cautioned and captured yesterday, I just found myself thinking, this is bloody hard. This is so hard to do. So a psychiatrist turns up at the family home of a kid who is clearly deeply, deeply troubled, let's say, and almost certainly dangerous, and the kid refuses to see him. Just says no. Oh, well, I'm afraid that's unforgivable incompetence and negligence on the part of the psychiatrist. So tell me what the psychiatrist was supposed to do. So I don't know where all the other avenues will lead, but they lead, I do know that they lead to people. And I don't know that there's any evidence that the system currently is inadequate to properly pursue those people, that the system's in place. If there is, as Paul reminds us, any argument at all for gross negligence or criminality, that is already in place. And when they allowed the mob to call the shots, in the case of baby P, when that appetite that was just brilliantly described by the last caller of your pain needs a target, it needs to go somewhere. And in the case of baby Peter, it went all the way to the head of children's services in Haringey, whose head was essentially called for by Ed Balls, who was then head of children's services, and who subsequently won a massive case for unfair dismissal, which took another 600... I mean, I presume they've got insurance and what have you, but the money that was paid to her, which she deserved, by the way, comes out of the pot, ultimately, in some ways, that the budgets for the care of the children would come out of. It's coming up to 10:45. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Have a go, because this is not a morning for particularly pungent arguments or disagreements. Have a go at identifying a positive. What would the positive be for society? Or, if you want, for the families, what would the positive be of naming people found to have dropped the ball? And that's an understatement, but I think it does the job. It's 10:45.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
How many times do we have to sit and listen to another report or inquiry that says the multi-agency that all failed, all passed the buck, thought, no, it doesn't quite fall under our remit. But I'm sorry, multiple occasions when this kid is turning up at school with a knife and the police don't seem to do anything. They didn't even arrest him. They found him on a bus with a knife, didn't arrest him. Forget it. And nothing will really change.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxing.
George is up the ribbon can without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book advanced single tickets from London St Pancras to Cambridge from only £11. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply.
With a new Volkswagen T-Roc. With £2,000 towards your finance deposit on the new Volkswagen T-Roc with Solutions PCP 7.9% APR representative. Test drive the T-Roc today and see why it won What Car's Best Small SUV Award. Ordered by the 4th of May 2026. Indemnities may be required. Volkswagen Financial Services.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper, to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato,
whoa,
and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1 or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with James O'Brien.
It is 10:48 and you are listening to James O'Brien. On LBC, Stephen Bush, as is often the case, has written an extraordinarily perspicacious piece about this horror show in the Financial Times today. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Grim Truths from the Southport Killings Inquiry, in which you can hear the intelligence almost. It jumps out at you from the page with which he's brought to this question, to this conversation. And there is one area that he is particularly strong on. That's the role of families. He points out that in Fulford's report, he writes, AR's parents' obstructive approach involved an outright refusal to take legitimate professional concerns seriously or to accept that AR's conduct was seriously unacceptable. That included seeking to justify him carrying a knife in October and December of 2019, and even seeking to blame his commission of an attack with a hockey stick at his former school on the schooling he was receiving. Regrettably, this element of parental self-deception continued even into the parents' oral evidence to the inquiry. And Stephen points out that this has an extraordinary echo with another case that you may remember, the killing in Luton of... It was a son, wasn't it, who killed his mother and his brother and his sister. I'm not going to say the name of the killer, but the victims were called Juliana, Giselle, and Kyle Prosper. And when the killer in that case was being sentenced in court, his father shouted in court, "I still love you, son. It's not your fault, okay?" So, in the face of that parental self-deception, that we might call it, and this is what we talked about on the show yesterday, how do you deal? And we took, again, as is becoming almost inevitable on this program, but I'm never going to be complacent about it or ungrateful, we took extraordinary calls on this as well. What do you do when the person you love becomes the person you fear? Those two most powerful human emotions, fear and love, to go a bit Donnie Darko for a moment. What do you do when they are in direct competition with each other? The person you love is the person you fear. And that is a backdrop against which these professionals, or the context in which these professionals, have to operate. And I don't know that any of us can be 100% confident that we wouldn't engage in parental self-deception if we found ourselves in similar circumstances. Which is why absolute racist meathead calls for the parents to be deported are so profoundly unhelpful to absolutely everybody and every... In fact, I said I wouldn't mention it again. A couple of you clearly weren't listening at the top of the programme, so I am aware of what that racist plum has said, but he's just desperately hoping that someone will pick it up and do a lazy phone-in about it, so we certainly won't be giving him that particular present on this programme today. 10:51 is the time. I still love you, son. It's not your fault, okay? And that was in a different case, but involving a young man who had clearly, for some time, been posing a clear and present danger to the community and the family in which he lived. So what would be gained from naming the professionals? Zach's in Portsmouth. Zach, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Hope you're well. Personally, I think that my point is, on the parental self-deception, I've got another sort of point that I didn't mention to your producers
tell me what you rang in to say first, mate.
So I rang in to sort of agree with that these professionals should be named and shamed to a degree. So I'm not saying in any way that this is about witch hunts, or, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, we say this one person is to blame for everything, because ultimately in this case, as is mentioned, there are a magnitude of issues that, you know, sort of led to ultimately this thing happening. I think, you know, personally, you know, I've got a background and experience with, you know, safeguarding issues when it's failed and ultimately almost come to, you know, sort of to a blow as such. But I think
just slow down a bit, mate. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Take a breath, cool. And then just talk to me about why you think that the professionals in this case should have their names put into the public sphere if the families simply decide that they haven't been sufficiently disciplined.
It's about setting a standard, and that standard being that failure has a consequence. You know, by saying that we don't have a problem with, you know, these people doing what they did, or
no one's saying no one's saying that. Everyone's got a massive problem.
What I'm saying is that, you know, if you're saying constantly there's a clear failure, negligence, you know, warnings were ignored, all of those sorts of things should be visible, you know. And if you've got people that are in a job like, for example, social services or CAMS, and they are failing, then they should be either named or shamed or removed from their role, because ultimately it's going to set a precedent that if you get it wrong to such a level where people lose their lives, then...
Yes, but there could be a million mistakes that are identical and haven't led to people losing their lives.
But you can't constantly play the what-if game. I mean, in my experience of what I went through, if the what-if had ultimately came to what would have happened, then, my daughter would be a completely different person now to what she is.
Right. I mean, obviously, I've got no idea what you're talking about, but you have a deep grievance with social services, do you?
It's not just that. It's
fully understandable. I just want to clarify, because I've not followed everything that you've said, and I just want to be clear and that's where you're coming from. You've been very, very badly let down by social services.
Yeah, exactly.
And was your daughter living with her mum and not you at the time?
And so that's how it started, but that's not how it ended. It started as a very sort of simple custody battle, not that it's called nowadays. But
in a way, and apologies that I can't get obviously a full grasp of everything that you've been through and everything that you've said, but in a way what you're demonstrating is why emotions can't come into these decisions, because you're very emotional whenever the words social services appear.
But that's where that parental self-deception, or whatever it is, the exact wording is, that's where professionals should take
what action. So let's talk about that. So the psychiatrist turns up at the house, and the teenager refuses to see him. What should have happened in that case?
So psychiatrist says to parents, cool, let's have a chat with them. But as you've already mentioned...
He obviously did that.
Exactly.
So what happens when the child is repeatedly refusing?
Fine, and that parent, as you mentioned, refused to help them engage as well, correct?
No, I'm talking about when the psychiatrist went round to the house and the parents are saying, come downstairs, and the psychiatrist is saying, come downstairs, and he's just refusing to. What should have happened?
So you mentioned that... Okay, so what should have happened is that child should have been arrested or detained under Section 136 of the Mental Health Act.
But he's not got any mental health issues.
But he's refusing to cooperate with a psychiatrist.
That's not a crime.
No, but it's detaining someone for their own welfare.
But there's no case for making that conclusion here. He's just simply refusing to come downstairs and talk to the psychiatrist.
The other point which you made.
No, I just want to focus on this point. What should have happened? Because your suggestion, respectfully, is ridiculous. You can't section him for refusing to talk to a psychiatrist.
But if I was to stand in a shopping centre and say that I was going...
But you said you didn't want to do what ifs.
I'd be arrested.
You thought you just said you didn't want to do what ifs.
But now you're standing in a shopping centre threatening to blow yourself.
No, I'm not. I'm saying literally this is what happened.
If you go back to the parental self-deception part, James, if you bear with me.
No, I don't want to bear with you. I want you to tell me what should have happened.
Nobody wants to talk about the actual real issue.
I'm sorry for what you went through. I'm very sorry for what you went through. What's the real issue, Zach?
So if you go back to the parental self-deception part, where the parents then obviously also didn't, facilitate and, they should lose their parental responsibility, the state should then take over the care of that child.
Well, it has. He's going to be in prison for the rest of his life. I'm very sorry for what you went through, okay? Even though I'm not quite sure what it was, but the idea that you... you can't even detain someone under that act, I don't think, if they're actually in their own house at the time. But again, I'm very sorry for what you went through. And I think the importance of not allowing emotions to cloud judgments as important and as far reaching as this one has just been somewhat unintentionally demonstrated rather well. So thank you for that. Laura's in Taunton. Laura, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I did actually call in just to talk about the complexity of what the psychiatrist could or could not have done. And in a way, it's quite an uncomfortable call because obviously it's, if you're at the receiving end of under-resourced services, you're going to feel particularly let down a lot of the time. But essentially, I don't feel that the practitioners should be named and shamed. I am a mental health social worker myself, and balancing rights and risk is incredibly complex. What I was saying to your producer is that underlying our practice has to be adherence to the Human Rights Act, Article 5 and Article 8. And so when that psychiatrist is sitting in that family lounge and this young man isn't coming downstairs, unless that person reaches the very, very clear legal requirements or the very clear legal framework, that person cannot be restricted. They cannot have their liberty restricted. And it's just such a complex nexus, because often, you know, the laws are in opposition to each other. And so, you know, all the time we're trying to balance the rights of individuals against the potential risk to self or others. And essentially, that's just what I wanted to share, is that...
I think that, in a way, your caller and the last lad's contribution sit in quite stark relief to each other, because it is very, very complicated.
It's very complicated.
And sitting in that house with the boy, and I don't know how we've ended up on this particular episode of the whole thing, but it's interesting that that's what you rang in to talk about before I brought it up 2 minutes ago. Mm. What could have been done differently in those circumstances? The answer is probably nothing. I think there's access to private family life, isn't there? And there's...
Yes, that's Article 8. Right. Yeah. What I was saying to your producer is, you know, I've worked with people who... And I work in adult services, which I'm very grateful for. I think, you know, your concerns that people might not go into children's services are very valid.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to work in children's services. What we can do, if we have enough time and resources, is basically what we call sort of mindful watching. So if we're aware that there's a risk and that risk could exacerbate, we have to bide our time and be constantly risk assessing, I beg my pardon, a dynamic risk assessment. And once that person reaches the criteria, for example, under the Mental Health Act or under the Mental Capacity Act, that also allows for restriction under Article 5, restriction of Article 5 rights.
Yes.
Then you can almost sort of activate those legal frameworks. But as your amazing first caller said, we are working in grossly under-resourced systems where we'll be sitting doing risk assessments at night time in our own time.
In constant fear of what would happen if you didn't.
Oh, I cannot tell you, James, the number of times that I've come home and I've struggled to fall asleep at night. Yeah.
I can only imagine, and well, I mean, happily being able to speak to people like you and Sarah, I don't have to imagine, because I can hear you tell me, but I'm never going to walk a mile in your shoes. Thank you, Laura, and I think we'll end with the observation that quite a few of you have made this morning, but I haven't. So you never hear about the successes that people like Laura and Sarah and others preside over or deliver, which presumably get harder and harder and harder, just as the likelihood of failures increase as a consequence of systemic failures and cuts and austerities. And what's the conversation about today? Why we should be taking more money away from people like this and giving it instead to the army or the navy or the military in general. And I don't know. I mean, maybe the need for more military is absolutely acute and urgent, but taking the money, as Lord Robertson suggested yesterday, from the welfare bill, which will include an awful lot of the areas that we've touched upon today, seems to me to be a little bit previous. It is 2 minutes after 11. I'm going to do something, and I'm not. I'll tell you after the news, because we're already a bit late.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Chancellor is due in Washington for talks after saying she's very angry the US went to war with Iran without an exit plan. Rachel Reeves says America's folly means families across Britain are suffering the consequences. Her comments coincide with an IMF forecast predicting the UK will be hit the hardest by the conflict's economic fallout. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, James Murray, has told LBC the country is prepared.
Analysts are saying they are saying that we are better prepared going into this crisis than we were to previous crises like in Ukraine, thanks to decisions that we've taken, the Chancellor has taken, increasing economic fiscal headroom and so on.
James Murray also refused to put a timeline on when the government will publish its defence investment plan. Sir Keir Starmer is yet to sign it off, even though it was due to be published last autumn. Yesterday, former head of NATO Lord Robertson warned a lack of investment has left the UK in peril. Ministers insist defence spending's increasing each year. Another two men have been charged over the murder of a 21-year-old student in North London. Finbar Sullivan was attacked on Primrose Hill last Tuesday. The two men will appear in court later. A second vote on a social media ban for under-16s will take place later. MPs previously rejected a Lords amendment to the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill while a consultation takes place. Andy Burrows from the internet safety charity the Molly Rose Foundation doesn't think there should be a ban. He's told LBC tackling the design of the platforms would be a better approach.
Parents across the country are crying out for further action. They want to see decisive action, but they want to have confidence that the measures that the government are going to take will work. And we've always had fears that actually a ban will do little to change the status quo. It will only leave parents with a false sense of safety.
A new women's health strategy for England is being unveiled by the government. It features an initiative described as a patient power payment. It allows women to share feedback on their care with funding potentially directed to areas where improvements are needed. The strategy, first published by the Conservatives in 2022, is being updated by Labour. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading down 2 points at 10,607. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, an unsettled and windy day for many. Rain moving eastward through the UK with a high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm David Dom.
Subway knows you're on the hunt for the perfect shawarma chicken. Well, people, you're in luck. How about one on freshly baked bread or even a wrap? Then there's the juicy, tender shawarma chicken pieces marinated in a traditional blend of rich, aromatic spices, topped with your fave fresh salad and drenched in a garlicky, tangy, yogurty sauce. The new shawarma spice chicken, now at Subway.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 11 is the time. So if I said to you now, who have I told over the years that they can come on this programme whenever they want? I've meant it, because I wouldn't say something like that on air unless I was absolutely telling the truth. Who would you put? And I'm going to wait for you to make some suggestions. So one of the people, and at the moment I can only think of one or two on that list, but you might think of others. One of the people on that list to whom I have said over the years, you can come on this programme if you think it's important enough for my listeners to be immediately appraised of it. You can come on whenever you want. One of those people has asked to come on today. And in order to prove to you how much of a man of my word that I actually am, I've got no idea why he wants to come on, or she, I've got no idea why they want to come on the programme today. I've just said, yeah, of course you can, because you're you, and I love you. And no, Brian, it is not Suella Braverman. We will find that out shortly after 11:30 today. And then, of course, shortly before 12 noon, Natasha Clark will join us to tee up PMQs, which... I've got no idea, really. Kemi Badenoch can't mention the war because she was all in favour of it until she wasn't. She can't really mention Donald Trump because she thought he was a stand-up guy and an absolute genius until he wasn't. I don't know what they can mention or what she will mention. But defence. She'll go on defence. So she will come off the back of the hideous inquiry into the Southport killings, which have found chronic underfunding, or which many of us believe demonstrate chronic underfunding in all sorts of areas. I'll wait to see if anyone guesses correctly who it is that's coming on, and then I will tell you who it is. I won't surprise you at 11:30 with the idea of who it is, but you'll probably work it out quite quickly. But Kemi Badenoch comes off the back of the Southport inquiry demanding that we move more money out of the welfare system and into defence, which currently sits, and this is the political problem that we didn't unravel yesterday. We didn't even try to. We went down a different path entirely. If it's the 14th biggest priority for the British public, then there is a failure in the system somewhere if it should be number one, which all of these people saying we need to spend more money on defence completely miss, that it would just be bad politics, wouldn't it, to prioritise the thing that the voters have at 14th on their list of things that they care about. It's a tricky old balance. It's a tricky old balance. 11:07 is the time. So we turn our attention next to a much softer territory. When is the last time, Mystery Hour not included, when did we last do a phone-in? Since that madman started his latest war. You know, the madman who said he will be ending all the wars. When was the last time we did what you might describe as a bread-and-butter phone-in? The kind of phone-in that we enjoyed having together, that sometimes they come around with a sort of degree of regularity. You can't do them too often. Sort of nourishing fare that that we like discussing, but which is not necessarily a matter of imminent international apocalypse. When was the last time? Have we got? Do we keep records of this stuff, Eleanor? Does anyone keep a record of what we do on this program, or does it just? It's just tomorrow's fish and chip paper. Really. Apart from the clips, as Keith points. Hey, guess who watched one of yesterday's clips? Would it be inappropriate for me to say, or would it be, or would it just be? Would it be charmingly boastful, or would it be unpleasantly inappropriate? Anyway, I may tell you a little later who is currently enjoying clips from this programme. But I want to talk about a pilot to test new school food standards. Listen, Jamie Oliver is not coming in at 12:30, but he's on the list. Jamie's on the list of people that can come on whenever they want, because I've got such much admiration for him and the work that he does, that if he thinks there is something going on that's important enough. Bill Browder is on the list, you're right, absolutely, but it's not Bill. A very short list of people who can come on whenever they want, because I trust their judgment and their track record so completely that they don't even need to tell me what it is that they want to talk about. They can come on the programme. All right, it's Martin Lewis. Okay, he'll be here at 12:30. There you go. Set your clocks. Go and make a cup of tea if you want, but make sure you're back. 11:30. 11:30. Make sure you're back. That's why I need him for the numbers. You see, he's my numbers man. I can't even tell the time. I've got it in front of me. I love Jamie, and I love the work that he does. And you have taken me on such a journey when it comes to the importance of healthy food. But there is a little, and I found the sight of the women, the mums, shoving junk food through the chain link fences at the schools where Jamie was trying to improve their dinners. I found that heartbreaking. That was another example, actually, of blood boiling and heart sinking, wasn't it? Because you're angry with them, but on the other hand, it's an act of love to give sweets to your child. I don't at me, it just is for some people. You like to see your child smile, right? Unless you're Donald Trump's dad. But most parents like to see their child smile. And if you give your kid a Mars bar, your kid will smile. And therefore and unfortunately, most kids are going to smile every time you give them a Mars bar. And this is where parental responsibility kicks in, to chime ever so inappropriately with the last hour of the programme. Every time you give your child a Mars bar, they're going to smile. So the job of a parent is not to give them a Mars bar every time you want to see your kid smile. But they are going to smile every time you give them a Mars bar. So there is a little bit of me that is tickled pink by the news today that a scheme designed to make school dinners healthier has triggered a decline in the uptake of meals. So this is a scheme in Brighton, a 6-week trial at a primary school, has actually seen more people opt for a packed lunch and reject the healthier options. The new standards, which are coming in very soon, ban deep fried food and sugar laden puddings. Launched on Monday, the people who know what they're talking about, Jamie Oliver and Henry Dimbleby, former government food czar, most obviously, have welcomed it. But there's an education catering company the people that have presided over this pilot in Brighton have reported that bringing in healthier school meals has triggered a 15% decline in the uptake of school meals. And when they undertook a spot check on a dozen packed lunches, that's a little bit fascist, isn't it? I mean, it says, show me your papers. No, sorry, your lunchbox. Show me your lunchbox. We have vase. They found that they all contained a packet of crisps and a chocolate bar, because of course they did. And this is where my tension kicks in, because I kind of get both sides of this argument. Of course we should be encouraging our children to eat more healthily. I'm not quite sure they've got it right with these blanket bans on everything. You remember when we first got sent the menu that was pinned upon a fridge, a listener's fridge in France, and we couldn't quite believe our eyes, or I couldn't anyway, because the food that they were being served at a state primary school in France was off the charts compared to what was being served up at state primary schools in this country. I mean, they had courses, I think, and like a bit of cheese and a bit of fruit and a main meal and a drink and a sort of rice pudding or a milk pudding. And it was just so different from what has happened in this country that you found yourself acknowledging that things could be a lot better. But at the same time, what's the phone in? I'll tell you what the phone in is. How do you get other people's children to eat healthy food? 0345 6060 973. That's it. So here is a school. Here is the doors. Here are the people. Here is a school where they have tried to improve the quality of food that children have been served. And the children have voted with their stomachs and asked their mums and dads and carers instead to take them off school dinners and give them a packed lunch. How do you deal with that? 0345 6060 973. And just to pick on something that Jeff has said, well, I'll pick up on that in a moment, Jeff, because I think you've made a category error in your contribution, which we'll look at shortly. But the government is currently giving £2.61 for every free school meal in England and Wales. It's a little bit more than in Wales and in Scotland or Northern Ireland. But why is there such a disparity? Why does £2.61 in England not deliver the kind of quality that you would expect? That's a question I think you probably need to be a little bit more qualified than I am to answer. But as they prepare to roll out a pilot, or not even a pilot, as they prepare to roll out the new standards across the entire country, how do you, in a way, I don't quite want recipes, but how do you deal with the fact that children will, until they are successfully trained or taught not to, children will lean towards the less healthy option? So think of the crisps and the chocolate bar in the lunchbox and tell me, hand on heart, right, I'm going to paint a picture. There's four children sitting around a table, right? Three of them are eating sandwiches with a packet of crisps and a small chocolate bar next to them. The other one is eating salad out of a bowl with some carrot sticks that they dip in hummus when everyone else is eating their chocolate. Now, just pause for a minute and analyse your feelings about that. Three children sat at the table in primary school. Let me change the picture slightly. One of them is eating the school dinner that has been served up. One of them is eating the free school dinner. One of them is not eating the free school dinner because they don't like it and they don't have any alternative, so they're going to go hungry. One of them is eating a packed lunch that contains a packet of crisps and a chocolate bar. And one of them is eating another meal that's been brought in from home, but which looks like the kind of thing you'd feed to a rabbit. Like a lovely salad, and instead of having crisps or sweets, they've got carrot sticks and crudités, as we call them in Brentford. They've got crudités that they are dipping into a small pot of tarama salata or hummus. And now tell me what you're feeling about those four children. Which one do you want to be yours? Which of those four children do you want to be yours? The one eating the salad and the crudité? The one happily eating the nutritious and healthy free school meal? The one unhappily staring at the healthy and nutritious free school meal, which they're not quite hungry enough to eat? And I'll tell you what, if you think that whatever your child is served is bad, I will take you back to Chattersley Corbett in 1981 and show you some of the slop that we were served up in that school that wasn't fit for pigs. And I know that because I used to feed it to pigs and the pigs would turn their snouts up. But, and then the fourth child is the child with the packed lunch from home. It's not like a box of Smarties. It's a couple of sandwiches. It's a packet of crisps or Watsits if you prefer. Perhaps pickled onion monster. Oh, I'm getting hungry now. And a chocolate bar. Now, which of those four children is yours? And now, which of those four children do you wish was yours? Because I think almost all of us, especially because it's free, would want our child to be the one that's eating the free, healthy and nutritious school meal. Because it's free. You say this in the order that you want. Because it's free. Or because it's healthy. Or because it's nutritious. But it's free, it's healthy and nutritious. The kid who's eating the even healthier meal, I feel a little bit sorry for. I'm not going to lie. Maybe I shouldn't. Tell me why I shouldn't. The kid who's not eating anything, I feel sorriest for. Because I remember what that was like. Going to class hungry, going to play rugby in the afternoon hungry because there's no earthly way you were going to eat that unidentified meat stew followed by semolina that you could stand your spoon up in. And the kid with the packed lunch is better than the kid who's not eating anything, but wouldn't it be even better if you hadn't had to pay for that packed lunch and they weren't eating the chocolate and the crisps because they were enjoying the delicious, free, nutritious and healthy school meal? So how do you do it? How do you turn the two kids, the packed lunch kid and the not eating anything kid, into the eating the free school meal kid? How do you do it? Because you can get over the Rubicon and you won't need the packed lunches anymore. But the problem with a scheme when it's new, and this is why I talked about the mums shoving the meat rolls through the chain link, shoving the chocolate bars through the chain link fence at the school where Jamie Oliver was revolutionising everything. You can't do it overnight. So how do you hang in there? How do you turn it into a school where every child is going to be eating the healthy and nutritious free school meal? 0345 6060 973. And have you done it? Because can you do it without sounding like that person? Like the person who gives their child crudités instead of crisps? Because nobody wants to be that person except the people who are that person. And the people who are that person don't realise that nobody else wants to be that person. 0345 6060 973. You launch a scheme in a school to have healthy, free school meals, and you end up triggering a decline in the number of kids having school meals. How do you fix that? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips?
Sometimes, pal, your best bet is not to bet at all. And BetVictor's app makes it really easy, simple and safe to do so. They've got lots of helpful features to help you manage your time and your spend online. But it also really helps that I can't find my blooming phone half the time.
Yeah, that does really help.
I don't even know where it is now. I can hear it, but I can't see it. Sandra!
Listen to Harry, and please, gamble responsibly. 18+, gambleaware.org.
Dreaming of a new kitchen? Getting started couldn't be easier. At Wix, you can begin planning your new kitchen with our design consultants. Simply arrange a free home measure or an in-store design consultation. Book your free kitchen design appointment and turn all your ideas into reality at Wix.
Hello, beautiful people! Get ready to rock with a new Volkswagen T-Roc. With £2,000 towards your finance deposit on the new Volkswagen T-Roc with Solutions PCP 7.9% APR representative. Test drive the T-Roc today and see why it won What Car's Best Small SUV Award. Ordered by the 4th of May 2026. Indemnities may be required. Volkswagen Financial Services.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
I've got one suggestion, and that is that you ban packed lunches. If free school meals are being provided for every child, then you can't have packed lunches. They're taken off the option list entirely. You cannot bring in your own packed lunch at primary school. And you'll have about a week of children coming home starving, hungry. Now I'm sounding like someone who went to a Victorian boarding school, aren't I? Do you know why that is? Yeah, because I'm someone that went to a Victorian boarding school. We used to have to sit. This is why I mentioned Semolina a moment ago. We used to have to sit until we finished. Everyone else went off to break. But if you hadn't emptied your bowl, and Semolina was the most, I mean, you could put it, I hope you're not having your lunch, but you'd put it in your mouth and gag. And you'd hold your nose. We had all sorts of tricks to get it down our gullets. Apparently, if you hold your nose, it turns off your taste buds. So we'd be doing all of that. And some kids still couldn't get over the line. I always remember one lad who was just sobbing into his semolina. So there's like tears and snot dripping into his, and he's having to spoon it all up. And I don't know what the rule was. They couldn't leave him there forever, could he? I'd be like that sort of scene in Benny Hill when they find all the ossified milkmen in the bedroom of a suburban semi. He couldn't have left them there until they turned to dust. So there must have been a rule, because that kid was never going to finish that bowl. It was about 60% snot by the time the rest of us had left the dining hall, had left the dining room. So if you banned packed lunches, would the food get eaten? I think it probably would if it was half decent. But now I'm reminded of a lad at my prep school whose parents sent a letter to the school insisting that he be excused leaks. Have I ever told you about this? So you could get a letter sometimes from the from matron or from the doctor, and sometimes it would come from home and sometimes it would come from school, and you would be what was called off games. So if you twisted your ankle or if you had a bit of an illness, you'd be off games, and you had to have a letter. You had to take a chit to the PE teacher or the games master, and you had to give it to them, and they would sign you as off games. This lad, I remember his name, but it wouldn't be fair to say it out loud. This lad got a letter off his mum asking if he could be excused from leeks. He was off leeks. The idea of eating leeks caused him such pain and trauma that his mother wrote to the school. He was a day boy, obviously. His mother wrote to the school. That's quite a niche joke there, sorry. His mother wrote to the school asking, please would you excuse from leeks, as he cannot abide them. And he comes home in a right old state whenever he has been forced to eat leeks. So I've got that in my mind, and I've got the hungry kid who's not eating anything in my mind, and then I've got the fact that they tried to introduce healthy food and the take-up went down by 15%. So what are you going to do about it? 0345 6060 973. Catherine's in Dumfries and Galloway. Catherine, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi. I would love my daughter to be on school meals because it's free, but she, and I keep trying to put her back on school meals, and they're quite flexible where we live. But she, most mornings, she, I went downstairs and she was making herself a packed lunch with,
how old is she?
She's nine.
That's good, isn't it? There you go. That's a silver lining. She's getting self-sufficient at quite an early age.
Well, yeah, but it's mainly because I keep forgetting to make packed lunch and then she had to have school dinners. But she was making herself mozzarella and tomato salad, cut up carrots, cucumber, raw mushrooms, and what's the other thing? Oh, and a piece of fruit. And that's what she chose to have in her school packed lunch.
I bet you're proud.
Yeah, well, I think mainly...
What have you done right, Catherine?
I don't know. She's always liked that type of food since we fed it since she was a baby. So I think she just prefers the taste of that food. I think if you've grown up on pizza and chips and, you know, crisps and chocolate, then you can't, your taste buds change a little
so,
bit.
So, I mean, the average school meal in Scotland comes in at £3.30. So it's about 70p more than the what the government gives for a free school meal in England, which makes me think that the quality in Scotland would be higher than the quality in England. But I sense that
she tells me that it's not, when I ask her what she's had for dinner, it's usually a cheese wrap or chips and pizza or something like
so
that.
So you're bringing in healthier food than she's,
yeah,
oh,
exactly.
You've just made a complete mockery. Oh no.
It's actually healthier.
Yeah, so I need a fifth chair. I need a fifth chair at my little table now, one of those tiny little chairs. I need to pull up a fifth chair because then we get rid of the free, nutritious and healthy school meal, because your position is that they're not getting a free, nutritious and healthy school meal.
No,
it is, out of those three things, it is only free.
Yeah, exactly. And I've had three children go through primary and secondary, and I wouldn't say that any of the meals in that they serve in school are that healthy. So, I mean, and I'm all for it. I'd love them to.
But under this pilot, they are. I mean, the government in England is getting rid of deep fried food, sugar laden puddings. I suppose that leaves pizza on the.
And
what? Chips.
Pizza and chips.
No,
yeah.
Chips are deep fried, so you can't, there'll be no more chips. The problem is, if they bring that in on Monday and everyone had chips on Friday, they're gonna have a insurrection on their hands.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
Yeah, well, yeah.
I don't know how we do it. I mean, it's whatever the opposite of too late is. It's not too early, but Catherine's little girl is there. She's there. She's there where we want every child to be. But how do you deal with the children who were nowhere near there? It's also made a mockery of my seating plan. Catherine's daughter. It's out right with her mozzarella salad. 27 minutes after 11. We're going to need a bigger table. Holly's in Sandwich, appropriately enough. Sorry. Carry on, Holly.
Hi. Thanks for having me on today.
You're not going to believe this. The next caller's in Pasty. Carry on.
So, I'm a mum of three young children who are in primary school myself.
Yes.
And I have been building an app called Lunchbox Lab for the last 10 months to empower settings to see whether or not their menus are nutritionally compliant and complying with the school food standards. But also, I think to your point earlier, you know, how do you actually get kids to eat it? I think it's about bringing...
On.
It's about bringing parents along on the journey as well and helping to educate parents as to why it's important.
I don't want to sound dismissive, but I'm kind of thinking of parents who are too busy to do that or not particularly interested.
I think you're right, but I think...
Remember, I went to very expensive private schools, and the idea of our parents being contacted to talk about what we were eating is close to comical.
I'm not sure I'd agree with that, because I think actually...
It's my childhood, you can't argue with me.
I went to private school as well, and I think actually private school parents do care a lot about nutrition and probably are... have a lot of opinions about
it. Probably all right now.
But I think that the issue is actually in areas where there's higher levels of deprivation, and it's about bringing those parents along on the journey as well. And you're right, you're not going to get every parent, but it's a trickle effect, isn't it? So if you get one parent...
Why not just ban packed lunches? And I know I sound like one of those radio phone-in hosts who just sort of comes up with a lazy, knee-jerk position and then shouts it until it's time to go home. But genuinely, if you just removed packed lunches as an option... And worked, as you point out, to ensure that the quality of the food that they're getting is as high as it can be, then you guarantee an improvement in overall health, don't you?
I mean, I do think that would be the ideal scenario.
Yeah, good, I do too.
Lunches aren't
not an option.
A thing, are not an option.
Because you sit there with your nice and health, let's work on the presumption that it's a nice and healthy and nutritious dinner, but you're looking at your mate who's got a kind of Müller fruit corner or something, and you're well jealous.
Yeah, and I do think that is difficult, and it does expose the differences, doesn't it, in terms of like what children are kind of bringing along. For example, like the school where my children go, the head teacher recently sent out an announcement about the fact that there are lots of kids going in with packed lunches, which is kind of old McDonald's or family-sized bags, family-sized kind of chocolate bars. I see parents coming out with and giving their kids kind of double packs of Mr. Kipling slices.
And so these are the kids who most need help. A cold McDonald's. I don't think I've ever eaten a cold McDonald's. I'm a big fan of cold pizza, but not for my children's packed lunch. That's an oddly poignant little observation, isn't it? That idea of what happens if you... So, okay, I don't think it is oddly a lazy, knee-jerk, typical old-school radio phone-in host position. Let's just shout it as loud as we can until it's time to go home. If you look at this story here, a 15% decline in the uptake of meals, children rejecting the healthier options in favour of a packed lunch, remove the option of a packed lunch from the equation. I don't think that is actually either lazy or knee-jerk or wrong. What do you think? You'll have to wait until after Martin has finished with whatever it is he wants to talk about, because I don't know, until we move a little bit closer to answering that question. 03456060973 is the number that you need. David Dom is here now with your headlines.
The Chancellor has admitted she's very angry the US went to war with Iran without an exit plan. Rachel Reeves is due to meet her US counterpart, Steve Bessant, who claims a small bit of economic pain is worth it. The Health Secretary says he wants to speed up access to women's gynaecology services as part of a new women's health strategy in England. Wes Streeting's criticised what he's described as a culture of medical misogyny within the NHS. And MPs will vote for a second time on whether to ban under-16s from social media. They previously rejected a Lord's Amendment to the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill while a consultation takes place. LBC weather, an unsettled and windy day for many. Rain moving eastwards through the UK with a high of 17 degrees.
LBC.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Hello, beautiful people! Get ready to rock with a new Volkswagen T-Roc. With £2,000 towards your finance deposit on the new Volkswagen T-Roc with Solutions PCP 7.9% APR representative. Test drive the T-Roc today and see why it won What Car's Best Small SUV Award. Ordered by the 4th of May 2026. Indemnities may be required. Volkswagen Financial Services.
Dreaming of a new kitchen? Getting started couldn't be easier. At Wix, you can begin planning your new kitchen with our design consultants. Simply arrange a free home measure or an in-store design consultation. Book your free kitchen design appointment and turn all your ideas into reality at Wix.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's...
My tip is...
Weight loss?
Forget that.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
26 minutes to 12 is the time. It is a short list, which you've reminded me of, actually. Jamie Oliver is on it, and you might have expected him to be turning up in the studio, given that we've been talking about school dinners. Bill Browder is on it, although given the ongoing situation in Ukraine and beyond, Bill's almost as busy as the man who is also on the list of people who can come on this programme whenever they want without even having to tell me what it is that they want to talk about. Martin Lewis, welcome.
Thank you very much. I like that intro. Thank you.
Well, why are you here?
So we had a win today, and I'm actually very happy. It's not often in this current environment you get some good news coming out. For the last 18 months, by my charity, the Money and Mental Health Policy Institute, we've been campaigning about council tax debt collection.
Ah.
Council tax debt collection is the most pernicious and aggressive and rapid form of debt collection. It would make banks blush.
Really?
No commercial company would be able to get anywhere close. Here's how it works right now. If you miss a monthly payment, within 3 weeks, the council is allowed to say, and the vast majority of them do say, you now need to pay for the whole year.
Whoa.
How someone who can't pay for the month can pay for the whole year is beyond me. Yeah. But what do I know about money? Then, within 3 weeks of that, they can take you to court, add an admin charge, typically £150, and send the bailiffs in for the year's debt plus the admin fee on top. There are 3.3 million people in the country, we think, in arrears on council tax. In 2024-25, the last year we have stats on, bailiffs were sent in 1.7 million times. This is a hidden, under-talked about issue that affects a whole class of people in society who are never being protected. And it, because you heard mental health in the name of thy charity, yes, that we do on this, it is particularly dangerous for those people with mental health problems, because you're three times more likely to be in crisis debt anyway if you have a mental health problem than everyone else. But today, we got good news.
That's incredible. Before we go on to the good news, how did this come to your attention in the first place?
So, I mean, so many case studies. When I set up the Money and Mental Health Policy Institute, which is a brilliant charity, we have a lot of success. We do lots of good work.
It's an extraordinary thing.
And we have, you know, there's amazing 30 full-time staff. One of the things I wanted to do that was a bit different is, our team are really clever people who've got great education and they come up with incredible policy solutions. But there is an issue with people who work in policy that they can sometimes be an ivory tower and not understand how it works practically on the ground. So I recruited at the start a lived experience panel. So we now, and we still have it, as over 5,000 people. By the way, as I'm on, if you've had mental health problems, we'd love you to join the panel. It's good. Just go onto the website, Money and Mental Health Policy Institute. But we under-index especially on younger men and men from ethnic minorities.
Okay.
And so we would love more of you. We'd love more of everyone, but we'd especially love more of you to come and all you do is you feed into what we're doing. And this came from our lived experience panel. We've got over 5,000 people, and they were saying this is one of the biggest problems we face. So we then looked into it, started campaigning and doing policy on it. So this has come from our people who have money and mental health problems telling us this is one of the things we need to prioritise fixing.
And give us an idea of, if not the worst case scenario, but a relatively commonplace catastrophic set of circumstances.
I had a case study this morning of a man who had a motorbike accident, was in hospital, and he had his move from 1 week to from 1 month to a year while he was in hospital because he hadn't been home and he hadn't paid his council tax, funnily enough, because he was in hospital having had a serious motorbike accident. Mm. We had a woman who, due to the postal delays, got her notification about having to pay for a year on Christmas Eve. But She hadn't, and she needed to pay by Christmas Day because of postal delays, because it was only a 3-week window. There's no breathing space.
And these are demands for a significant chunk of change.
Well, yeah, yeah, grand.
Obviously, that these people won't be able to find.
And then, so she went and got credit card debt at 40% interest, catastrophized the finances. And guess who has to bail you out when you're in trouble? The councils. It's counterproductive. So what has been announced today? We had a consultation last year. This is the good news bit.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, I met Angela Rayner about it first, and she was brilliant. She got it, and then we got a live on Good Morning Britain, and then Steve Reid, who's the minister now, they've got it. That 3 weeks is to become 63 days. So if you miss a monthly payment, a council cannot, and they can go longer if they want, a council cannot ask you to pay for a year within until 63 days. So you've got 2 months. Now, 2 months is similar to the breathing space scheme that you have for consumer debt.
Yes.
Which means, if you're having a problem, 3 weeks is not long enough to sort it out for most people. Listen, let's be honest. My phrasing in my press quote on this is a great first step.
Right.
I'm not saying this is a solution or what I would have done if I was in charge, but this is a monumental improvement. And they're capping the admin costs that can be added to £100. I'd have liked to see it at 70, but currently many charge 150. And this is the first change in council tax debt processes for 33 years. And when you speak to the debt counselling agencies, your Citizens Advice, your National Debt Line, your Step Changes, and you talk to them about debt, they say, we always prioritise council tax because it is the most dangerous council tax debt collecting, way worse than normal consumer debt. Do you know who's second worst after council tax?
No.
Central government debt collection.
Really?
Yeah.
Do we know why?
Yeah, because they don't have any of the consumer protections
there's
in
no
place because they're not regulated like the FCA regulations, and there's no consumer duty like consumer lenders have. And also, when you start to talk to governments about it and they go, oh, well, that might reduce the amount that we collect.
But I was wondering about that because this is revenue as well as...
It is. Now, my argument on the council tax thing is actually we don't believe this is going to cost councils any money. Because ultimately, if you're asking people to pay for a year and they don't have the money to pay for a year, you're not getting it.
Yeah.
And the end result on people's finances and well-being, which leaves people in a worse state, I mean, it has really hardcore impacts. You will have lots of people this has happened to who can't deal with it, actually puts burdens on councils. And there are councils out there who've tried to go a different way. The vast majority just go as hard and fast as they can, who've employed their own debt collectors and put in different places where their bailiffs go in and offer help. And one of the other things changes that's going in here is in those 63 days, and we're still talking about the mechanics of this with the government, the councils will have to signpost people for help with their debts. So rather than going, 3 weeks, want all the money, it'll be, just so you know, if you don't pay this in time, you're going to have to give us all the money, but here's some way you can go to help to get your finances in order so you can pay.
It's often the way, isn't it, with debt? Those of us lucky enough never to have fallen into these sort of holes presume that it's like a sort of a mandibles that they get you and they grab. But usually, if you phone the right people or if you contact the right organisations, they're keen to help you get through it because of the reason that you've just highlighted.
Within the consumer sector, yes, but not within
but
the
not
council
here,
sector.
But
and that's why we're raising it. Yeah. Because ultimately, demanding people to pay when they can't pay doesn't work, right? So what you actually have to do is you have to put... So there's a difference between won't pay and can't pay. And most of these cases are can't pay.
Yeah.
And so what you actually do is get people into a position where they can't... So another thing Money and Mental Health has done, which is now being piloted, and this is one of our other big campaigns, is within mental health counselling centres, they're now going to embed debt counsellors because the link is so strong. And over 70%...
You know, forgive me, but I'd have hoped that was already in place.
No, it's not. But
clearly not.
But we've got... It's the pilot it is.
Yes.
And I'm semi-making this stat up. It could be 60, it could be 80. I'm going with 70 because I can't remember. It's 3 years ago I read the document.
Yes.
70%, slightly made up, of mental health caseworkers and counsellors are spending a significant portion of time of filling in financial forms for their clients. And they're not professionals at it.
No.
So our idea was, why don't we get the mental health people to do the mental health, and let's get the debt and money professionals, who actually cost less generally, to do debt and money help in the same place at the same time. And also, if you've got financial problems, the treatment time for clinical depression is thought to take 18 months longer, right? And if you've got mental health problems, you're three times more likely to be in debt. The idea that these two are discrete, they're not discrete, they're completely interdependent on each other, and sorting out people's finances helps their mental health, and sorting out people's mental health helps their finances, and stopping coming in and using a blunderbuss if you can't pay a monthly council tax that you'll have to pay a year, and treating constituents worse than customers seems to be quite a sensible way for me to go for me.
A few people pointing out you've clearly had your Weetabix this morning, Martin.
Well, I did mention I was meant to be on my way to the gym before I came, and I had my my performance-enhancing caffeine, which I don't normally have when I'm on air, so forgive me, I'm wired.
No, it's absolutely lovely to see you with your dander up, but it's lovely to see you all the time. And while I have you, because people will have picked up on your... You are close to euphoric about this. The report that Money and Mental Health Policy Institute published was only in 2024, and you now have government action on something that is...
18 months is amazing.
I mean, that is absolutely incredible, and it explains in part your joyous demeanour this morning. But and I've asked you this before, but I want other people to hear your answer to this question. Why do you care?
If you... Sorry, you got me there. I meet people walking in the street, James. And there is a sense of desperation for many people. And especially on this council tax issue, I can't tell you how many desperate people I met. That's why I burst into tears when I got when we first said they'd do the consultation. I've met so many desperate people that this has just ruined their lives. And you can't not have that rub off on you. You can't. And I have spent my whole career trying to help people with their money. I've been incredibly financially successful on the back of it. Some of that is talent. Some of that is hard work. Some of that is skill. But a lot of that was luck. And I think there comes a responsibility when you've been successful, and which will always be due to an element of luck, that you need to pay it back. And I'm in this bizarre, highly pressured and stressful, and it makes me ill with it at times, position that if I start a campaign in my area, please be everybody know, it doesn't work outside my area, in my area, I probably, and I hope this isn't self-aggrandizing, I'm the person who can deliver it most quickly and most effectively. So I can't do every campaign, and lots of people want me to do things that I can't, but we took this one on and we've delivered it within 18 months. And that makes me really happy because I have met so many people. Won't change their lives because it starts in April 2027.
Sure.
But I know the soft impact on millions of voiceless people that this will have. And that's why I care. I don't know if that's a proper answer or not, but I wasn't expecting the question.
It's an absolutely perfect answer. You can find out more about this and indeed about all of the work that Martin does in these fields at the Money and Mental Health Policy Institute website. And of course, you're here, or rather you were able to do this as a consequence of the success of Money Saving Expert, which many people still and will always continue to benefit from enormously. If there was any doubt about why you have, I think in Nando's, is it a black card in Nando's that you can get free chicken for the rest of the year? You have whatever it is, the golden ticket for the James O'Brien program. And if there was any doubt about why, I think you've just summarily removed it all.
Thank you for having me.
Now get yourself to the gym, but don't drink any more coffee.
No more coming. Thank you.
It's 11:45.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why don't you get the Prime Minister on the phone and say, come on, Sir Keir, we've actually got to show some action here.
Straight to the point.
It's the most puerile rationale you could imagine.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
This is not a one-off incident.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
The new single drops. The world tour begins. As artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios, practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome! Apply now at globalacademy.com.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. All wobbly, all wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Hey, you! Yeah, you! What would you like from your investing app?
6% interest on your ISA, a free share of your choice, or no commission on stocks and ETFs up to €100,000 per month. With XTB, you get all of the above all in one app, the XTB app. Get your free share and start investing with XTB today. XTB, where your money works.
Capital at risk. Investment values can rise or fall. Limited free stock availability. 2% ISA rate boost for 90 days. New clients only. T's and C's apply.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's...
My tip
weight
is...
Weight loss?
I... No, forget that. Never, you never just
keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
Selling your car can be super simple if you choose We Buy Any Car. Now in their 20th year, they're on average 11 minutes away. So help is never far. If only they could make finding a good driving song simpler. No. No. Oh, definitely not. We Buy Any Car. Selling made simple. To sell your car today, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
11:48 is the time. He's gone now, so I can tell you something about Martin Lewis, who was with us just a moment ago. And I have to tell you, the quality of compliment, admiration and love that's coming in for him, the consequence of that interview, is almost high enough to make my own ego start objecting or start writhing in jealous response, but only almost. It carries it. It weighs on him, this extraordinary burden of responsibility that he has chosen to take on. This is why I love the guy, in ways that I can't think of many public figures who inspire similar feelings in me. We were at university together, but we weren't friends. We barely knew each other. It's fair to say we had rather different enthusiasms in those days. But I kind of been conscious of him, career-wise, before he became who he is today, when he first started appearing on TV programs and radio to talk about personal finance. I don't think I know anybody who is as empathetic and socially responsible as him. And that's why I ambushed him at the end with that question that you heard. But I just wanted to tell you that if you are ever out in public with him, it's extraordinary. Keith and Eleanor are probably more starstruck by Martin Lewis coming into the studio than they were when Tim Roth dropped by to say hello the other week, or when, I don't know, Gary Lineker pops in. But if you're ever out and about with him, it is quite extraordinary how we, the public, connect with him. And the reason for that, I think, is because he has essentially helped millions of people to save some money on their shopping, or to save some money on their mortgage, or to get some compensation for something they were missold. And because he has somehow, entirely organically and almost accidentally, ended up with this status, he reaches people in ways that nobody else in British life does, which is why he is routinely found to be the most trusted person in public opinion in this country. And I've never seen him as happy as he was today. Caffeine overloads notwithstanding. I love that, because he gets nothing out of this. You will not be surprised to learn that Martin Lewis has never got into trouble with his council tax, and he never will. But he is as happy there as I have ever seen him, because of the help that he has afforded to future problems. People in the future in serious trouble. And I just think it's beautiful. I'm sorry. I know I'm supposed to be the sort of, you know, hard-hitting radio bloke or whatever, but I just think it's absolutely beautiful. And it's a privilege and a pleasure to know him, but both professionally and personally. Right, no more of that nonsense. Let's get back to beating people up. Mike's in Fulham. Mike, what do you want?
Hi, James. Long-time listener. Anxiety pinging like crazy right now.
Let's hug it out, Mike. There we go. Carry on.
Okay. So you're asking, how do we get kids to eat food? I think the trick is to aim to replicate the food that they associate with fun times, like going out for Joe Chicken or Nando's, if I'm allowed to use the names and things like that. But obviously replicating it, just using fresh ingredients and not giving them chips and giving them roast potatoes, but actually flavouring the food, because that's all kids really want. I mean, if there's an option between a nice
you know, looking piece of crispy fried chicken and something that just looks bland and dead, you know, obviously any of us are going to choose the most attractive.
I sense you speak from experience.
Yes, I do. I'm a small independent school caterer in West London.
Oh, okay. So you, I mean, you're literally serving it up, as it were?
Putting the menus together. Team of 11 guys in our kitchen every day. We only cook one principal meal plus some alternatives, but obviously cultural, religious, and basically to help kids who have issues with eating or vegetarian,
kosher food, halal food.
But
all
of that. Our main driving force is one main meal.
What is it today?
So today is an 18-hour cooked organic pork collar made into a chili with a variety of beans and served with rice.
Flipping heck.
Or chicken.
I was going to say, I just went to the coach and horses through those cultural and religious sensitivities. I'd fancy that, actually, for lunch today.
Yeah.
Can I, if I'm in the schools where you work, can I bring a packed lunch instead?
No, you can't. That's the whole premise of the school.
There it is.
Everybody who comes to the school is aware from day one, if the kids wish to attend, that the school meals are obviously the free school meals. We're lucky to be in London, to be honest. And as somebody who's grown up in kitchens himself from my childhood and gone through 10 different schools in different countries and having eaten all sorts from everywhere, I think that the problem is just too much choice and the fact of the corporatization of everything and the fact that giant corporations are running all of the food that's feeding our kids, really, and we all know where the priorities are there.
Yes, I mean, it sometimes is simple and straightforward to work it out. If it is a system built entirely upon how can I make 5 pence more out of every child in this school, then I am going to probably serve less. So you need to have a threshold and a balance, but you also need to remove the option to be unhealthy. And that some parents will struggle with that, but not for long, not forever.
Yeah. And also, it's making the... You can make good food and make it similar and close enough flavor profile to where they only have to try it once or twice and actually realize it could be much worse.
Yeah, no, of course. Yes, and I know, I think all parents would recognize that. And did you work in the independent sector? Did you say that?
Yes. Okay. I'm actually in a free school.
Oh, okay.
So we have free school meal children in the school. Obviously, we're in West London. So our school accommodates everybody from every possible imaginable
background. So it's doable on scale, then, and it's doable entirely within the state system.
Also on menu, because obviously we're lucky enough to live in London that our kids are from so many different backgrounds. We're all from somewhere else, and we've all, you know, and our food reflects that, because obviously we're cooking Caribbean food one day, we're cooking Chinese food another day, we're cooking, you know, whatever it might be, and obviously that's going to relate to all the kids in a different way.
So, and so it is not, and this will sound like a deliberate dad joke pun, but it really isn't. It's the only phrase I can think of. It's not pie in the sky. It is deliverable.
It just wouldn't make the money that
what you do. You set it. You don't allow anybody to come in and start saying, how can we make a few more quid out? That is the deal. That is the contract. That is what it is. And if you I don't know how you do that last bit, though, when they say, right, we'll feed them for £2.50 a day. And then they're coming, right, but we're getting £2.50 a day, so we have to make sure that the food costs £1.50 a day. That last bit of the equation, that's more for Martin than me. That's business and finances. But people like you in the kitchen, then, the future is achievable. The goal is achievable. But I don't think, and I'm surprised at this, because I normally rail against the sort of disciplinary and authoritarian attitudes that coloured my own childhood. I don't think packed lunches should be an option. Thank you. And nor does Mike. Catherine's and Isha with the last word on this, because Natasha is here to tee up PMQs. Catherine, what would you like to say?
Hi, Dave. Hello. Yeah, I am a public health nutritionist specialising in children's nutrition, so this is something that's really close to my heart. And I think in an ideal world, it would be fantastic if we could just, you know, serve one thing and the kids will eat it. And your previous caller has obviously worked really hard on their menus and has really fantastic ways of cooking the food for the children. But I think we do have to be sensitive, because the problem with banning packed lunch, goes back to your private school scenario, boy who was sobbing into his semolina, there will be some children who actually, if we don't make packed lunch is an option, they will sob into that school meal, regardless of how delicious we might think it is, or how tasty we've made it, or how we try to replicate their sort of home food. There will be some children who would actually rather starve themselves, go hungry all day long, than face that school food. So I don't think that banning packed lunches is the answer. I think we have to support the staff. We have to not just issue these new school food standards and expect them to adhere to them straight away. They need training. They need support. They need with that. But also, crucially, I think it comes back to the early years. And this is where I bang on and on and on. We can't expect children to turn up at the school gates and accept school dinners.
It's really tricky. It's turning around an oil tanker.
Exactly that. You know, if they have never been exposed to these foods, the early years is that really crucial stage of development.
Well, that makes it even harder. I could listen to you for longer, I apologise, but I am conscious of PMQs, which is one of the few moments in the week where I don't ride roughshod through all of the scheduling and indeed the clock. But that of course makes it harder from a school provision point of view, because you're almost providing different levels. So you start making sure the early years are getting onto the right horse, but the older years, the later years, are still going to be able to ride the wrong horse. Thank you, Catherine. And yes, so I am obviously modifying my ban on packed lunches with various exemptions and caveats for children who either have examples of autism involve an inability to deal with certain textures and certain foods, and there would also be neurodiversity kicking in on why this wouldn't work, or I don't know that I would accommodate the kid at my school whose mother asked for him to be excused from leeks in a letter to the headmaster. I think I would still insist that he has to eat leeks, or at least that he isn't allowed a packed lunch. He can eat everything else on his plate. So yes, we moderate my stentorian packed lunch position. Natasha Clark is here. What's coming up today? On PMQs, or anywhere else, really, frankly.
Well, I quite like to hear more about what you used to have at school dinners in terms of semolina. Isn't it used for puddings, or is it used mainly for sort of pasta and other bakes?
No, semolina is a pudding. Well, it is used for pasta, but if you mixed it with water, made it into like a paste.
You can use it to make...
And then that's what you would serve.
Okay.
But it's like a paste. It's okay, a bit like wallpaper paste.
Oh. I mean, it doesn't make you sound very appetizing.
But not as tasty.
Not as tasty.
Well, what is the leader of His Majesty's opposition likely to do today?
Yes, so obviously defence is the flavour of the week, isn't it, with that warning from Lord Robertson earlier, and I wonder whether she will go again on defence spending, which she's done repeatedly, and the Prime Minister has not had quite an answer, really, on exactly when the government will increase that defence spending. There's also a vote on social media today in the Commons. Kemi Badenoch has repeatedly pushed this idea that she thinks social media should be banned for under-17s. I don't think we're going to get through this PMQs without mentioning Donald Trump. I'm sure Ed Davey will be the one to raise
that.
Yeah,
because
Kemi
Badenoch won't be.
She's not going to be the one to raise
it. She can't mention the war because she was in favour of it until she wasn't.
Exactly.
And she can't really mention Donald Trump because she thought he was a brilliant man until he wasn't.
Exactly. And that sort of rules out her using the economy as a topic today, because we're talking about this IMF report. We're talking about how the UK is going to be hardest. It doesn't completely know, but
she might just...
It's less
either not understand or pretend not to understand that the responsibility for difficulties regarding cost of living doesn't lie with the failure to drill the North Sea or with Keir Starmer. She'll bring that
up. Sure, she might bring that up. She might. I think the economy, Iran and defence are probably my most likely. But a wild card option today, she's just put on social media, actually, a link to this BBC investigation. Legal advisers help migrants to pose as gay to get asylum, according to this undercover investigation from the BBC. She's saying, just on social media just now, anyone caught in this racket must face the consequences of being struck off and prosecuted. It's quite an extraordinary investigation.
Struck off what?
I think she's referring to the people who are involved in this investigation, who are helping migrants to...
No, I saw the story, but what would you be struck off? The professional register?
That's a good...
Because it's an illegal activity.
I presume she means
a professional register of criminals?
I presume what she means is struck off from their job and be prosecuted for it. But she's not specified. But it is an extraordinary investigation.
Yeah, it's an odd thing for the BBC to have done, I think. It's tiny, tiny, tiny numbers. Mm. And very much a Daily Mail approach that they're all liars and they're all wrong and they're all pretending to be gay. There's plenty of journalists who want to do that kind of thing. I'm just surprised the BBC are getting involved.
Yeah, so she might raise that. I think that's a word of a wild
card. It's not Keir Starmer's fault, though, is it?
Will
he now promise to fire all of these people from jobs that don't exist?
I think she will probably try to feed it into a wider argument about the migration system being, in her eyes, broken, in her eyes, lots of people making what she believes to be inaccurate and false claims.
Yes, so. Fair enough. And of course, she joins honest Bob Jenrick in completely ignoring the fact that they bore responsibility for all immigration policy for the last decade and a half.
I'm sure she won't mention that at all.
Can we just help Ben out, Natasha? Would you mind? Ben thinks that you just said that the vote is banning social media for all under 70s.
I'm sorry,
Did I say 70s?
No, you
didn't say that, but it's Ben's ears. He's in his 70s, you know. Oh. He's probably not... He said, I like my Instagram, James, he says.
Okay,
but
well,
Ben, you are safe. Your Instagram is on not...
Ben, I don't think we're going to ban it. I don't think we're going to ban it at all. But thank goodness for that. Good to clarify. Yeah, under 16s is the proposal for a fresh ban. It's been in the House of Lords. They've tried to...
Here we go. Let's find out.
Mr. Speaker, that was a very interesting answer from the Prime Minister. Lord Robertson, who authored the government's strategic defence review, has said the Prime Minister has a corrosive complacency when it comes to defence. Why did he say that?
Mr. Speaker, let me start by saying I respect Lord Robertson. And I thank him again. I thank him again for carrying out the strategic review. My responsibility is to keep the British people safe, and that is a duty I take seriously. That is why I don't agree with his comments. Last February, that was 7 months after taking office, I took the decision to increase defence spending from 2.3 to 2.6%, paid for by a difficult decision on overseas aid. Last June, at the NATO summit, I committed to raising core defence spending to 3.5%. Last November, Mr. Speaker, the budget committed record funding to defence. I reaffirm those commitments now. The spending, the Strategic Defence Review is a 10-year blueprint for national security. The Defence Investment Plan will put that into effect. It will be published as soon as possible. We need to get it right. We inherited plans that were uncosted and undeliverable, and we're not going to repeat those mistakes.
Mr. Speaker, he says he doesn't agree with Lord Robertson. Lord Robertson is a former Labour Defence Secretary, a former NATO Secretary General. He also said, and I quote, "We are underprepared, we are underinsured, we are under attack." He said...
Order. I don't think it looks good, shouting somebody down at the dispatch box.
Mr. Speaker, Lord Robertson's criticisms were of the Prime Minister, and he said Britain's national security is in peril. Our armed forces are at the end of their tether, waiting for this government to fund the Strategic Defence Review. There are still 2 weeks of the parliamentary session left, so why won't the Prime Minister publish the Defence Investment Plan before then?
Mr.
Speaker,
I remind the House that we've put in place the biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War. Mr. Speaker, let me spell that out. That means we're spending £270 billion over this Parliament. That's £5 billion more this year, with defence funding increasing every year. These are record amounts, Mr. Speaker. Decisions of a Labour Prime Minister, a Labour Chancellor and a Labour government. And what a contrast. Yep. When they came into office, defence spending was 2.5%. Yep. When they left, it was 2.3%. Yep. When they came into office, the army was 100,000. When they left office, 72,000. They cut frigates and destroyers by 25%. Yep. They cut mine hunters by 50%. Yep. She said at the weekend, "Our defence is the weakest for 400 years. That is what they left behind.
Mr. Speaker, he's talking about the biggest sustained increase. Talking about an increase is not the same as giving an increase. The military and the defence industry want to hear about what he's going to do, not him prosecuting past governments. He promised the Defence Investment Plan would be punished. He promised that the Defence Investment Plan would be published last autumn. I asked him at PMQs 6 weeks ago when it would be published. He had no idea. It is now the middle of April. What's the hold-up?
Mr. Speaker, I've set out my position. The Defence Investment Plan is the first line-by-line review of defence budgets for 18 years. She talks about talking. If you're going to support and make your country safe, you have to get the right calls on the big issues. She called for us to jump into the war. They could pretend otherwise. I remember walking in, standing here for the first time, saying we would not get drawn into the war, we would not join the offensive, and they all shouted, shame. They remember it. I remember it. They're just embarrassed by it now. A week later, when she realised she'd made a massive error of judgment, she attempted the mother of you all U-turns. That didn't work. So this weekend, she said, when I said we should jump into the war, she said this weekend, Mr. Speaker, that what she meant, she was talking about verbal support.
Prime Minister, it's Prime Minister's questions. We've got to concentrate.
Just answer the question.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister loves to misrepresent my position on Iran. He loves to misrepresent it. Let's stop talking about what I didn't say. Let's start talking about what he isn't doing. Mr. Speaker, you will recall that on Monday, I offered to work with the Prime Minister to identify the welfare savings we need. What did he say? No thanks. Now that Lord Robertson has said, and I quote, we cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget. Will the Prime Minister think again and work with us to find savings to fund defence?
She was clear in what she was saying. She said we should give verbal support. I suppose that's standing on the side and saying, get in there, good luck, mate, you've got this. Mr. Speaker, that is her approach. We are reforming welfare and spending more on defence. They did neither. The welfare bill rose by £88 billion on their watch. It soared by £33 billion under the Shadow Chancellor's watch. We're fixing it. What did they do? They voted against it. They voted to keep the broken system. So taking advice from the party opposite on reforming welfare and defence spending is like asking Liz Truss how to keep your mortgage down.
This is so poor from the Prime Minister. This is... Labour MPs are laughing, Mr. Speaker. This is a moment of profound national seriousness. And what are they doing? They're promoting sex toys in Parliament. That's what they're doing. Mr. Speaker, it gives a whole new meaning to fiddling while Rome burns. Mr. Speaker, it has been... That's what they're doing, Mr. Speaker. Let's get back to the issue of the Defence Investment Plan and defence spending. It is being reported that the Treasury is asking the MOD to make £3.5 billion worth of cuts this year. He won't fund our military because he wants to fund more welfare. That's why he has a welfare plan to 2031, but no defence investment plan at all. Now that the Chagos surrender deal is dead, will the Prime Minister put the billions saved from ditching Chagos into defence, or is that going into welfare as well?
Prime Minister...
Mr. Speaker, we are spending more on defence. Record amounts on defence. £270 billion in this Parliament, £5 billion extra. And she talks about the Chancellor. It's because of the decisions of this Chancellor we've got the biggest boost to defence spending since the Cold War. We've also got the biggest pay rise for our armed forces for over 20 years. We've also got the biggest investment in military housing for over half a century. What did they do at the budget? They voted against all of that.
That sounds like he doesn't want to spend the Chagos money on defence. Well, Mr. Speaker, Labour MPs will know Lord Robertson, a former defence secretary, a former NATO secretary general. He is Labour through and through. They all need to think about why he stuck his head above the parapet. I went through the Strategic Defence Review with Lord Robertson last year. The Lib Dems and Reform refused to meet him. No other party is taking this seriously. So, Mr. Speaker, I want to ask the Prime Minister a very specific question. In January 2024, Conservatives approved an upgrade of destroyers like HMS Dragon so they can better intercept ballistic missiles. In July 2024, the Prime Minister paused that plan. Will he immediately approve and fund that critical upgrade now?
Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, the Dragon was commissioned by a Labour government, as it happened. But she stands and says, please forget the fact that we hollowed out the armed forces. Please clear up our mess. I went to the Gulf last week and thanked our armed forces for protecting British lives. She said we should have jumped into the war without thinking about the consequences. Then said, oh no, we shouldn't be in the war the next week. Now she says, what I meant was we should give verbal support.
Order. The front bench, I expect them to be quiet here. I also expect it, but it's the same people. I suspect next week you won't be in for PMQs if it carries on, Prime Minister.
In addition to saying her position is we should just say to the Americans, get in there, she insulted our armed forces, Mr. Speaker, saying they were just hanging around. These were pilots who, within 2 hours of this conflict, were up risking their lives, taking missiles out of the sky. And she insulted them. And she's never apologised for that. She said a few weeks ago that serious times call for serious people. She is not one of them.
Ian Byrne.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As the Prime Minister said, 37 years today, 97 innocent children, women and men, went to a football match and were unlawfully killed at the hands of a corrupt state. I was at Hillsborough and I was one of the lucky ones who survived and walked away. As parliamentary leader to the Hillsborough Law, I stand here with a huge sense of obligation to the 97, all the families, including my constituent Debbie Matthews, every survivor and every victim of a state cover-up, who were all part of this collective campaign. There are signs of progress after last night's government concessions, but we've heard this before. Prime Minister, this is your responsibility. It is within your power to take control of this process and make good on your promise to deliver this legislation. So will you commit today to ruling out any carve-out for security services and finally delivering a full Hillsborough Law worthy of the name, or will they be failed by the state once again?
Prime Minister.
Well, I know, as my honourable friend has just said, that he himself was at Hillsborough, and can I thank him for his decades of campaigning for justice. I am personally committed to working with the families to get this bill right. It is integral that their views are heard. We're discussing this precise issue with the families, and we're going to make sure that he is fully updated. I reaffirm my commitment to delivering the legislation, to ensuring the duty of candour applies to all public servants.
Shred David, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I echo the words of the Prime Minister about the Southport inquiry and also the 37th anniversary of the Hillsborough tragedy? Our thoughts are with all the families affected and the survivors, and I hope he will deliver on the Hillsborough Law. Today, Mr. Speaker, also marks the third anniversary of the start of the devastating civil war in Sudan. I hope he will recommit to real action in the face of the world's greatest humanitarian catastrophe. Mr. Speaker, in a phone call with Sky News last night, President Trump has threatened to rip up his trade deal with the UK as punishment for us not joining his idiotic war in Iran. Mr. Speaker, this must be the last straw. Surely the Prime Minister can't send our king to meet a man who treats our country like a mafia boss running a protection racket.
Minister.
Can I join him in his comments about Sudan? We often overlook the fact this is the greatest humanitarian crisis facing the world at the moment. My position on the Iran war has been clear from the start. We're not going to get dragged into this war. It is not our war. A lot of pressure has been applied to me to take a different course, and that pressure included what happened last night. I'm not going to change my mind. I'm not going to yield. It is not in our national interest to join this war, and we will not do so. I know where I stand. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the King's visit, this, the purpose of the visit is to mark the 250th anniversary of relations and independence, obviously, of the US. The monarchy is an important reminder of the long-standing bonds and enduring relationship between our two countries, which are far greater than anyone who occupies any particular office at any particular time.
Mr. Speaker, the President Trump is one of the most unpredictable people we have seen on the world stage, and I hope he does not embarrass our monarch. But moving on, Mr. Speaker, last year the Prime Minister claimed he'd done some special deal so Brits would be able to sail through e-gates at EU airports. But that's not the experience of families returning from holiday this week. Long queues at borders and passport controls are the latest symbol of the Brexit disaster. But they're also a symbol of this government's failure to repair that damage. So will the Prime Minister apologise for misleading British travellers? And can he tell them when they will be able to sail through passport control?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've made it very clear that I think our national interest lies in close relationship with the EU on defence, security, energy and the economy. And I was very pleased that at last year's summit we did negotiate an agreement on e-gates, and we're pushing hard on that. We have another summit this year where I intend not just to make good on what we've already agreed, but to go closer to the EU in the relations that we have.
Joe White.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was promised Prime Minister questions. A meeting.
And
with the Prime
we're back
Minister
in the room. 18 minutes after 12 is the time. We will pick over the bones of what we have just heard after this.
LBC. Our pet's in a pickle. We know your furry friends get up to all kinds of mischief. Like when the dog scuffed that entire chocolate cake. All the time the cat tested his nine lives from the curtain rail. Again. That's why we're here when it matters most, with fuss-free pet insurance policies, including unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Hey, you! Yeah, you! What would you like from your investing app? 6% interest on your ISA, a free share of your choice, or no commission on stocks and ETFs up to €100,000 per month? With XTB, you get all of the above all in one app, the XTB app. Get your free share and start investing with XTB today. XTB, where your money works.
Capital at risk. Investment values can rise or fall. Limited free stock availability. 2% ISA rate boost for 90 days. New clients only. T's and C's apply.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato.
Whoa!
And spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less less. Irish Ferries, see travel differently. T's and C's apply.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
20 minutes after 12 is the time. Simon Mark's with us after half past for a catch-up with all things American. Although, to be honest with you, I sometimes get a bit... You'd think, wouldn't you, being in a studio where, to paraphrase Hamilton, in the room... This is not the room where it happens. There might have been stuff that's happened that we've all been too busy even to notice, because this kind of programme doesn't produce itself, you know, or indeed present itself. So I can't tell you with absolute certainty what Simon Mark's will be talking to us about. I can tell you that J.D. Vance, the vice idiot, vice president of the United States of America, has been lecturing the Pope on theology recently, which is right up there with Donald Trump comparing himself to Jesus. I want to do a phone-in about what Donald Trump-supporting Christians believe in, because it is not Christianity, up to and including the 10 flipping commandments. Most obviously, I suppose, thou shalt not commit adultery, or thou shalt not covet, or thou shalt not bear false witness. It doesn't add in the Bible, because it was written quite a long time ago, thou shalt not bear false witness about US presidential elections. Thou shalt not incite insurrection. Anyway, what do they actually believe in, these people? Because they are a huge part of US politics, and clearly the part that J.D. Vance thinks could propel him all the way into the White House. But that's for another day. Speaking of, I don't know quite what word to insert into the conversation there, but I have a little hook and tease for you before we get stuck in with Natasha to what's just happened at PMQs. Have a little listen to this.
Can I also ask what changes you would make in regards to deportation to Afghanistan?
Oh, very, very, I mean, very interesting. I've already got two countries agreeing that if we win the next election, they will cooperate with me.
Wow. So that's two fully functioning governments that have agreed to cooperate with Nigel Farage in the event of him winning the next general election. I can't wait to find out who they are. That's off the top of my head. Do you think it was France, Germany? The actual governments as well, remember? Not just sort of randos. Who could it be? Australia? Where was the place that that Rishi Sunak was going to send everybody and Kemi Badenoch was going to send everybody? What country was that? Was that Rwanda? Was it Rwanda? I can't wait to find out, and I promise that I'll remember to reveal all before the end of today's programme. Natasha, it was all defence, was it? Apart from that very, very, very strange joke about sex toys.
Yeah. Do we want to repeat
no,
it? Do you want
don't.
To hear it again?
No,
okay, good.
I don't.
It
was a joke that someone...
It made me cringe. It was pretty awkward, pretty embarrassing.
Physically cringe.
Horrible. Keir Starmer made a good joke about taking advice from the Conservatives is like Liz Truss, like asking Liz Truss how to keep your mortgage down, which I think gave a little bit of a giggle in the room. But Kemi Badenoch's sex toys joke, which she's referring to one of the Labour MPs who's talking about trying to have a bit of a conversation about sex lives. She made a really poor joke about that, which I don't think quite worked. She's trying to, you know, she spent the entire of PMQs trying to be the serious politician asking these serious questions.
Oh, yeah.
And then that just totally unraveled it in just 1 second.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
It struck me as a joke, and I use the word very loosely, made by someone who doesn't really have a sense of humour. Because she's the kind of person, all she finds funny is cruelty. You know, she's the sort of person whose idea of comedy is other people hurting themselves.
Well, I don't know about that, James. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure I think that is the case. I mean, I'm somebody that likes a sort of, you know...
Slapstick.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Showing over on a banana skin.
Do you think that that's what she is?
I think she might be a bit nastier than you, but that's a conversation for another day. what I'm nodding towards is that is a sort of joke that someone who doesn't understand humour would make, because it's got words in it and it sounds like a pun and it's got sex in it. And if you were sort of putting together an algorithm on
what's funny at Prime Minister's questions, that might be something that would pop up.
Yeah.
Didn't. I can see that. But actually, she has made some very cutting.
Yeah.
And I think she has made some very witty jokes in PMQs, and generally I think she's all right. But that one did not land at all.
Absolutely off the chart.
But equally, Keir Starmer, an absolute lesson today in how to dodge any form of questions about defence spending. And, you know, he's totally right to chuck the Conservative record on defence spending under the bus. And I thought what was good about his performance this week is he actually had some stats to back it all up, saying, you know, Labour have put it up by this amount. The Labour government, we've put it up by this amount. Under the Conservatives, it went down by this amount. This is where the troops were at 100,000 troops before they left office, and now they were at £72,000 when the Conservatives left. So there were some nice backing up statistics that enhanced Keir Starmer's argument. But he wasn't able to answer any questions. When is the defence spending going to go up? When is that going to come? When is that defence investment plan that he has promised for months going to come from? And actually, I think his insistence that he wants to turn every single question into a question about the war in Iran, I think we differ on this point, I think it makes him look a little evasive.
Well, you misrepresent me horribly, Natasha. Absolutely heinous misrepresentation. I think if he wants to turn every question about defence into a conversation about a war that is currently happening, that's fine. But if she was asking him about, I don't know, fishing quotas, and he was trying to talk about the war in Iran, then you'd be 100% right. But she's not. True. She's talking to him about defence when her own position is so muddled on what's going on in Iran that she can't actually talk about it.
Yeah, and actually, to be fair, Keir Starmer didn't say, well, how are you going to raise the billions of pounds that we need to fund defence properly? And that was a question that he could have pulled around on her. But obviously, Keir Starmer is doing what any good politician will do. He's on a stronger foot on Iran, therefore he should make the most of a political opportunity, and he does it every time, but actually I think the evasion of the questions, he just doesn't seem to be able to answer them. And actually, you heard from the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, again today, this is Prime Minister's questions. Mm. Prime Minister, you can't just keep asking Kemi Badenoch the questions that you want her to answer. It's actually about you. And I think he comes across as a little bit disingenuous when he's not able to address a little bit of the substance of what she's saying, even though his argument, I thought, this week was a lot better.
Is it? I mean, they are going to deliver it. They have to. He's not going to announce it at PMQs under pressure from Kemi Badenoch. I wonder where the line is between an unjustifiable delay and an entirely justifiable delay. Because his argument that we want to get it right, that covers quite a lot of ground, but probably not all of the ground. You couldn't still be saying that a year from now, for example. Mm. But I wonder where it is.
How long does it take to turn around the tanker?
Yes. You know? Yes. And also worth reminding everybody that we weren't driving the tanker for the last decade and a half, but you are driving it now.
Absolutely. And he has to answer those questions at some point about what he is going to do. It's no use blaming the Conservatives forever. He now needs to say, look, I know the Conservatives have totally gutted defence. Here is how I plan to turn that around and to change that.
But the other problem,
but how long does that take?
Is that it's 14th on the things that the public care about at the moment.
Yeah, I speak to people who I know that work in the defence industry, and they say that actually it's a question of, well, when we put it up to people, well, would you like to spend more on defence? Most people say yes. But when you say to them, OK, well, we'll take money from schools, we'll take money from the NHS, they go, absolutely not.
Because they are much higher on the list. In fact, you have reminded me of a missed information that I meant to do earlier in the programme, but happily, thanks to you, I will actually be able to do now. And it ties in precisely and quite perfectly with what you have just said.
Missed information.
Thank you, Emily. We refer to Lord Robertson and his contention that the government needs to start stripping welfare and putting the money instead into defence, which we covered in depth on this programme yesterday and have touched on in some detail in depth today with Natasha, but which every single item of coverage that I've encountered, including my own, mea culpa, as the Romans would have said, omitted the fact that George Robertson, Lord Robertson, is currently employed as a senior counsellor with a US-based consultancy called the Cohen Group. And a cursory glance at the Cohen Group's website reveals that they assist aerospace and defence firms on policy, business development and transactions. We have helped firms from the US, Canada, UK, Europe, Turkey, Israel, GCC, India, Southeast Asia and Japan to succeed in North America, Europe, the Middle East, India, Latin America, East Asia and Southeast Asia. TCG, the Cohen Group, has assisted clients to compete for and win tens of billions of dollars in contracts to enter new international market. So that's the man calling for the British government to start spending millions and millions more on contracts that the company employing him as a consultant boast about helping their clients to secure. Not suggesting for a moment that that necessitates any conflict of interest, but I think it probably should have been included in my coverage yesterday. I'm not responsible for anybody else's standards.
Missed information.
Thank you, Emily. And then Donald Trump and Ed Davey, as you predicted, almost perfectly.
Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't mention the Pope picture, though. That's what I thought he was going to talk about. And I think you're discussing about Christianity and what people think and what the sort of MAGA movement, the Christian MAGA movement, think. Mm. I'd love to know what
people...
So would
I. We'll tune in tomorrow.
Yeah, great. think about that image and, you know, his incredible excuse that this is not all about, what did he say? He thought looked like he was being portrayed as a doctor.
Well, have you seen the latest explanation? Because you know that people think that he started using the word excursion because people around him had used the word incursion.
Does he know what the word excursion
means? He probably doesn't, but someone said, we're doing an incursion in Iran, and he goes on television and says, it's an excellent excursion, it's the best. So there is a suggestion now that the press office was preparing to announce that the image had been doctored, which is a meaningless intervention, but it takes some of the heat off
it.
Yes, exactly. But he then went on television yesterday and said that he thought he was a doctor in the picture.
Did he maybe just mishear?
Yeah, that seems possible, or misunderstand.
Have I told you my story about tequila?
No.
There is a prominent journalist who once mistakenly... heard the word tequila.
Yes.
But actually, the person he was speaking about was Kia. So it happens.
It could happen to anybody.
It happens to anybody. I'll tell you the full story off it.
Yes, a Kia Sunrise. Natasha Clark, great stuff. I think you got almost everything right this week. And all of your jokes were better than Kemi Badenoch. It is 12:31. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Matt, oh, hang on. No, before we go, can we just tee up that thing again? The little hook and tease. Yeah, clip one, please, Keith Lee.
Can I also ask what changes you would make in regards to deportation to Afghanistan?
Oh, very interesting. I've already got two countries agreeing that if we win the next election, they will cooperate with me.
Well, I can't wait to find out who it is. You will have to wait until after the very latest headlines with Matt Hewitt.
Sir Keir Starmer has told Prime Minister's questions in the last few minutes he is not going to yield over the Iran war after Donald Trump threatened to amend a US-UK trade deal. The Chancellor is due to meet her US counterpart in Washington, D.C. He claims security from Iranian threats is worth a small bit of economic pain. Sir Keir also told the Commons he doesn't agree with comments by the former head of NATO, Lord Robertson, that Britain's been left in peril by a lack of military investment. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, urged him to publish the defence investment plan within the next 2 weeks. And a former schools minister has told LBC the government's a little frightened of tech companies as it decides whether to ban under-16s from social media. Lord Nash has put forward an amendment to a bill that would introduce such a ban. It's being debated by MPs this afternoon. LBC weather. Some sunny spells, but a band of heavy rain moving eastwards across the UK. Highs of 11 to 18 Celsius.
This is LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
Now time to thank our partner on this episode, Sandals Resorts and British Airways Holidays. When we go on holiday, we want a bit of luxury, don't we? We work hard and we want to give ourselves a proper treat. And at Sandals Resorts, that's what you get. Scattered across the Caribbean, you can expect the best beaches, incredible accommodation, up to 16 restaurants per resort, unlimited premium brand drinks and cocktails, loads of activities topped off with sensational sunsets, all included in the price. It's a kind of luxury that means you can fully relax because everything, and it really is everything, is taken care of. You can book all of this through British Airways Holidays with a low deposit and flexible payment plans so you can spread the cost. So, let's go. You're all about the beach life now. To book your dream all-inclusive holiday and mine to be fair, visit ba.com/sandals. Terms and conditions apply. At all protected.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
Simon Mark's standing by. Goodness knows where he will start. But before he does, I just want to deliver satisfaction on another element of the programme that we've been enjoying today. Let us remind ourselves, I was going to do a competition. It's too late now. I should have done it earlier in the programme. Eleanor, just have a look at some of the answers that have come in, will you? And then we will reveal what the real one is. But first, here's the question.
Can I also ask what changes you would make in regards to deportation to Afghanistan?
Oh, very interesting. I've already got two countries agreeing that if we win the next election, they will cooperate with me.
Right. So who's he been in secret talks with, and which extant and functioning governments are prepared to do a deal with him on the deportation of refugees and asylum seekers? The most popular suggestion to come in is Russia, as you'd expect, because Russia, of course, is led by the man, the murderous dictator, who is also the politician that Nigel Farage admires most in the world. Belarus comes in second. Saudi Arabia and North Korea are in joint third. But no, you're all wrong.
The Taliban, by the way, they're not my mates, but the Taliban have said they would accept people back from us to Afghanistan. They've said that already.
What, so what, the Taliban that literally make women cover themselves up and stone people to death for daring to speak out? I must have misheard. Who is it, Nigel, that you've done a deal with to deport genuine refugees and asylum seekers?
The Taliban, by the way, they're not my mates, but the Taliban have said they would accept people back from us to Afghanistan. They've said that already.
Whoa. Of course, I mean, he also claims that Donald Trump's not his mate anymore, which is quite a reverse ferret from the days when he was so far up Donald Trump's backside that when the president broke wind, Farage whistled. And I presume he'll say he's not. He tried to claim that he wasn't mates with Vladimir Putin, didn't he, as well? But it was David Dimbleby, I think, or Jonathan, one of the Dimblebys. How embarrassing that I keep getting them mixed up. It was Dimble Both that pointed out that he did actually say that the politician he admires most in the world is Vladimir Putin, and then he tried to lie about how he'd never actually said that. But thankfully, Dimble Both is an interviewer who manages to see through his charlatanish behaviour. But even I, as a veteran chronicler of Farage's hideousness, even I am shocked to discover that the first government with which he has struck a secret deal is...
The Taliban. By the way, they're not my mates, but the Taliban have said they would accept people back from us to Afghanistan. They've said that already.
Why has he been conducting secret negotiations with the Taliban? Behind the back of our actual elected government. And why is he so in love with countries that have genuine, full-fat Sharia law? Questions that Laura Koonsberg will not be asking him anytime soon. Here is Simon Marks to bring us up to date with what is... Where do you want to start, Simon?
I think we should probably start with Iran, James, because it has become apparent over the last few hours that there is going to be another round of talks that is expected to take place in Islamabad. The president keeps saying that it could occur within the next couple of days. I mean, my understanding from a colleague in Islamabad is that the Pakistani prime minister is actually not in the city and won't be back until the weekend. So I think we are probably looking at the weekend for talks to occur. Vice President J.D. Vance, and let this sink in for a moment, said last night that what President Trump is looking for is to strike a grand bargain with the Iranian government. He's looking for a grand bargain with the brutal, murderous, some of his supporters say, Nazi-style government of Iran that back on March the 1st, hours after the U.S. and Israeli military action began, the president, of course, was insisting the Iranian people should rise up and topple. Now is the moment for action, he said. An historic opportunity for Iranians to take their own fate into their hands. All of that now appears to be over, and the president has spoken in an interview recorded yesterday afternoon, but broadcast here this morning at breakfast time, to Fox News. He was asked by reporter Maria Bartiromo to explain to his own MAGA base, the America First audience that largely tunes in to Fox News, why on earth he had decided to engage in this military excursion, as he often likes to call it, to Iran.
I had to divert, because if I didn't do that, right now you would have Iran with a nuclear weapon. And if they had a nuclear weapon, you would be calling everybody over there, sir. And you don't want to do that.
Well, you keep saying was. Is this war over?
I think it's close to over, yeah. I mean, I view it as very close to over. You know what? If I pulled up stakes right now, it would take them 20 years to rebuild that country. And we're not finished. We'll see what happens. I think they want to make a deal very badly.
Is the president really indicating that from his perspective, this war may well already be over, and insisting that he has accomplished something? I think there are huge questions about that, given that the Strait of Hormuz was open for business before the war began and is now very much closed by order of President Trump and as a result of the enforcement of the U.S. Navy. And on the detail of the negotiations that he's having with the Iranians, remember that Donald Trump used to call, and indeed still does call, the old internationally backed Iran nuclear deal that from the American perspective was signed off on by former President Barack Obama. It was the worst deal in the world. It was the worst deal history had ever recorded. Well, he is now trying to persuade the Iranians to agree to a 20-year freeze on enrichment activity. They are currently offering him, according to the reporting of the New York Times yesterday, only a 5-year freeze. The Iran nuclear deal set in train a 15-year freeze on Iran's uranium enrichment activities that Donald Trump excoriated, didn't want any of these so-called sunset clauses in the agreement. So now, not only are we looking for a grand bargain with the remaining regime leaders in Iran, but we are looking at one that could end up being very similar to the worst deal in the world that Barack Obama signed, the JCPOA.
And frankly, he'd be lucky to get it. I mean, the closer to that deal that it is, the luckier he would be. I mean, it almost sounds, Simon Marks, as if you are suggesting that the regime hasn't been changed at all. Speaking of regimes, a bit of Saudi pressure on this latest blockade that is actually a blockade. It looked for a while as if it was a blockade that wasn't a blockade, but today I think it's a blockade that looks like it might be a blockade, although it operates in tandem with the other blockade that they promised would be unblockaded. Carry on.
Yeah, I mean, there, yesterday, as we know, there were some ships that were transiting, Iranian vessels that may have been spoofing their precise location in a bid to undercut the U.S. naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. How committed he is to this, I think, is very much in doubt. He is desperate, again, for an off-ramp, not least because his Saudi backers have called time on this naval blockade. The Saudis are terrified that the Iranians may seek reprisals via their Houthi proxies and shut down vital routes in the Red Sea that the Saudis use to get their oil to world markets. So he's lost Saudi Arabia. As you know, he's now shredded his friendship with Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, because she committed the cardinal sin of defending the reputation of Pope Leo, who has come under, over Orthodox Easter weekend, no less, has come under this extraordinary ongoing array of blunderbuss assaults by the President of the United States. So no alliance any longer is safe. But the fact that he's lost Saudi backing for the naval blockade, they're calling time on it. They're saying knock it off. And essentially that is exactly what he is going to do. If he feels like he can get the deal, any kind of deal from Iran that he wants. But you made a really important point, James. Iran is in an extraordinarily powerful position still, because they can sense his desperation to get this thing wrapped up.
And of course, just as always, since the very start, the way that he can withdraw without the more credible claim of victory, although entirely bogus, is going to end up being the most important factor in the mix. You mentioned Giorgia Meloni. Italy also pulling out of a defence agreement with Israel this week. So she seems to be swimming in a rather different direction from where she has, and indeed Italy has been previously. But a quick word about Hungary, if you would, because we've covered on this programme the extraordinary extent of expenditure that Viktor Orbán's regime was deploying to influence public discourse in this country, sponsoring journalists, think tanks, so-called think tanks, offering very lucrative fellowships to people who were simply charged with getting very right-wing talking points into the British media. America has had its version this morning.
Yes, absolutely. And this has been revealed by Peter Magyar, the incoming Prime Minister of Hungary. But there is, I think, in a way, no surprise to this. Hungary under Viktor Orban was prominently backing CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, in many ways one of the most influential voices on the right and the far right in the United States. I mean, we kind of knew this because CPAC had held five separate meetings of its own in Hungary, significant events that brought the world's right to Budapest and other locations in Hungary. But the revelation of the extent of funding for CPAC again underscores what an enormous reverse Viktor Orban's loss is to Trump, to his movement, and of course to Vice President J.D. Vance personally, who went to Hungary in the final days of the campaign, urged Hungarians to back Viktor Orban. We saw Donald Trump taking to his social media feed and quite literally trying to bribe the Hungarian electorate in the hours leading up to the election, yeah, saying to Hungarian voters, if you put Orban back in power, I am going to flood Hungary with money and business and deals and help put the country on the path to prosperity. An open effort to bribe voters in Hungary, the likes of which we may well see in the United Kingdom in the UK's next election. Because remember, this is all part of Trump's official national security strategy to promote what he refers to as patriotic European parties, and unlike all past presidents in the modern era, directly to intervene in other countries' election campaigns and endorse candidates. And there's every possibility that we see that the next time British voters are called on to go to the polls, and we see Trump intervening on behalf of his favourite candidates. Although, as Giorgia Meloni's sudden fall from grace within Trump's inner circle has now shown, anything can happen between now and it's a long road to Damascus.
And of course that endorsement is losing currency by the day at the minute. Even Nigel Farage has been claiming recently that he barely knows Donald Trump. He just sort of bumped into him once in a lift entirely by coincidence, and they've got no deep-rooted relationship or close friendship or anything of the sort. So watch that space particularly. I am asked, and I suspect you are probably even more than I am, whether or not he is, and forgive the demotic here, Simon, but I can't think of a more responsible word. He seems to be increasingly bonkers.
Well, he is. I mean, I don't think that there's any way of avoiding recognizing that. We see it here on a daily basis, and it has been open season in terms, suddenly, of the conversation about his mental health. We've seen the New York Times tiptoe up to it. Last November, they published an article about why he kept falling asleep, and he appeared to be so fatigued, although they didn't touch the issue of his mental cognition, except reporting that Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary, said it was impressive. Then a few days ago, we saw an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying that the world has to come to terms with the fact that the Trump administration is psychotic, that America is now a psychotic state.
So
that's an interesting way of putting it, right? The administration is psychotic, not necessarily its leader. And then yesterday, the New York Times chief White House correspondent finally got clearance to publish a piece openly questioning whether the president has lost his marbles. And one of the reasons why, James, I think we're seeing this story being slow walked here in Washington is because we are now in a situation where, bizarrely, and reflective of the president's own lack of seriousness about the job of governing, hundreds of reporters in this town now have his personal cell phone number. You can reportedly buy it on the black market
if
you want to.
How much?
I don't know. I haven't found out.
Make some calls, Simon.
Find out. So hundreds of reporters have his personal cell phone.
I'll give it to Ian Dale.
Number.
Ian Dale can ring him live on the site.
So when you see these telephone interviews with Trump that are cropping up all over the place all the time, it's because a reporter has managed to get his cell phone number, and they're ringing, they're dialing that number on repeat again and again and again in the hope that the president picks up, and occasionally he does. But the issue here is that reporters with his number, and look, I'll be honest, I had a conversation with a very good friend of mine, another reporter here in town yesterday, and we were discussing, you know, neither of us has it, should we be trying to get it, how do we get it? But once you've got it, and you start making those robo calls to him all the time in the hope that he's going to pick up, I mean, there is a complicity there with the bonkers nature of this government and this president. And as a result, I think, you know, if you're a journalist and you've got his number and you talk to him every now and again and he picks up the phone and, you know, you get him to talk about whatever issue you particularly want him to talk about, whether it's Iran or taking another pop at Keir Starmer or whatever it happens to be. I mean, and I think journalism schools will look at this in the future if they any longer exist.
Right.
There will be questions about whether there isn't complicity there in a presidency whose leader is evidently unstable and quixotic and mercurial. And why would you then go and write a story about how unstable the president is? Because it may lead to circumstances in which he's no longer president, and then you'd lose your access.
You're having your cake and eating it, I suppose. And of course, it's reporting what he says unfiltered that poses the problem, because if you were to put it through the lens of proper analysis, then that allegation or that exposure to the possibility of complicity would probably be reduced. Good Lord. Well, you did well today. You're only about 6 minutes over schedule. That's a classic example of the pot calling the kettle black. Simon Marks, we'll speak soon. Stay safe, mate. It's 12:51.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Is the choice facing us prepare for warfare or welfare? Talks between Lebanon and Israel. Iran talks resuming. Where is the hope? And are you wild about Harry's views on parenting?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Do you ever feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day? Ferroglobin is a great tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of haemoglobin. Ferroglobin from Vitabiotics at Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com.
If you were missold a home on a holiday park, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900.
Dreaming of a new kitchen? Getting started couldn't be easier. At Wix, you can begin planning your new kitchen with our design consultants. Simply arrange a free home measure or an in-store design consultation. Book your free kitchen design appointment and turn all your ideas into reality at Wix.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine, and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun.
Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxing.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book advanced single tickets from London St Pancras to Cambridge from only £11. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
I'm sorry, it's not just the Taliban, of course, that Nigel Farage has been negotiating with. He said in that clip I played earlier that there are two bodies with which he has secured some sort of deal. So it's only fair to let you know what the other one is.
Bird of Manning.
Of course it is. Have you heard of the Gratitude Games? You should have done, because we covered it on this programme last year when they were trying to get up and running. It is essentially an event designed to raise much-needed funds to support the mental health of the UK's emergency responders and the NHS. One of the co-founders of the entire shebang is Sam Ryder, who joins me now alongside the project director, John Maycott. Sam, I'll begin with you, if I may. Where did the idea come from and why is it so important?
I became involved back in 2019 when Mike Downard, who you interviewed with Ricky Nuttall in that previous interview, gave me a call and said, look, I've had a dream. And his dream, as you described quite clinically almost, is that there is such a problem with mental health within the emergency response workers and across the NHS that is not recognised. These guys see things that you and I hope we will never see, maybe three or four times in our lifetimes, whereas they, and the stats are astonishing, they will perhaps see them 400 to 500 times in their lifetimes. And obviously that has a devastating effect as they stick. And our view, our objective now, thanks to Mike's initial vision, was we need to take care of the people who look after us on our worst day, and they have to do it day after day, whether they are in good shape or not. So the games, as you say, they're there to bring people together. It's to create a community annual event which recognises and celebrates what these people do. And through that recognition within the community, raise funds through either personal sponsorship or donations so that we can improve their mental health.
There's
There's
a beautiful symmetry to it as well, isn't there? Because the games are open to, and I'll run through the disciplines that you can enter shortly, to serving and retired emergency responders and their families. So it's raising money via, through and for some of the greatest public servants in the country. The charities involved include the Ambulance Staff Charity, the Blue Light Card Foundation, the Firefighters Charity, Police Care UK, 999 Reset and PTSD 999. And we're talking about human beings that everybody cares about, but which we often forget about. John Mayock, you're the project director, but also yourself a three-time Olympic athlete, European and Commonwealth medalist. Are they going to be any good? It's quite a pool that you're picking from. Where do you derive your confidence that they're going to be any good at angling, archery, clay shooting, cycling, equestrian events, golf, lawn bowls or road running?
Well, we'll have to come along and take part, James. We'll give you a guaranteed entry there. I know that. I could see you with a fishing rod. But absolutely. You know, what we want, one thing that we wanted to kind of have this project is inclusive, fun, exciting, open to all. And that's why, you know, we've got a mix of sports in this whole program, because we know through Mike and Sam is, you know, the whole kind of emergency responders are engaged in so many social activities. And, you know, for this year, we just chose these particular eight just to see how it all goes and then build on it across the future years. But, you know, the foundations are there to have a really exciting event. You know, the event's going to be, you know, taking part over a couple of weeks in Manchester. Manchester are great partners.
It'd be lawn bowls, actually, for me, mate, if I was going to get involved in anything, but it wouldn't be fair on everybody else. I love this because it's not too late to get involved, is it? People can go to gratitudegames.uk right now and get involved either as a donor, Sam, or indeed as a participant.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key thing. It's open now. We're actually widening as well beyond simply emergency response, family and friends. We're saying there are certain events which we feel the public should be part of. If it's a celebration for our emergency responders and NHS staff, let's everybody get involved. And that's the key thing. As you say, go to gratitudegames.uk. Please enter. If you don't, if you can't, then there's a donate button on the website. And if you are not entering yourself, if you've got family and friends doing it, you can sponsor them. So, yeah, if you go to the website, then all the details are there. And it, as John says, it's a wide range, which we hope to be wider in years two and three and onwards, because we want this to be an annual celebration.
Good. Well, we'll continue to help you get the word out there. And
I think thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We should end on a more serious note. It's running from the 3rd of May to the 12th of June. And we are talking about people who, as you said at the outset, Sam, who see things that no one should ever have to see and who inevitably sometimes struggle with the consequences and struggle sometimes even more to find the help and support that they need. So although everyone will have a wonderful time in Manchester in May and June, it's important to remember the very unpleasant business that these people engage in every day, and that you are minded to help them overcome and move through. Thank you both, Sam Ryder and John Mayock from the Gratitude Games. As you heard, you can find out more and you can even enter. I could actually slide up there for the lawn bowls, I reckon. Gratitudegames.com UK. You can find everything you need to know there. Thank you, chaps. That is it from me for today. If you missed any of it, you can listen back on your free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download them from your app store. Range of podcasts, including Full Disclosure. You know all that already. Tom Storbritt's going to be here at four. Here's Sheila Fogarty.
It's a disgrace.
Sorry, shall I do it again?
No, absolutely not. I'll do it again at four for everybody. Thanks, James. At three today, it's not hard to see why, is it, that Prince Harry would wish to cleanse himself, as he put it, of aspects of his past, excruciating being the children of that marriage, I imagine. But is it time for him to stop talking about his past? At two, Israel and Lebanon have held talks for the first time in over 30 years. Will it stop the shelling in both directions? The talks between Iran and the US look set to resume as well. So focus on the Middle East at two. I'm going to start really where I left off yesterday on defence. Is it for us, the British public, as well as the Prime Minister and the government, is it a question of warfare versus welfare? Keir Starmer's been defending his defence spending, but he cannot escape the pressure to say and spend more.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Sir Keir Starmer says he is not going to yield and join in with the Iran war after Donald Trump threatened to amend a US-UK trade deal.
We're not going to get dragged into this war. It is not our war. A lot of pressure has been applied to me to take a different course, and that pressure included what happened last night. I'm not going to change my mind.
He was speaking at Prime Minister's questions in the last hour. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is due to meet her US counterpart in Washington, having complained that America's folly means families across Britain are suffering the consequences. Scott Bessent claims security from Iranian threats is worth a small bit of economic pain. Sir Keir Starmer also told PMQs he doesn't agree with comments by the former head of NATO, Lord Robertson, that Britain's been left in peril by a lack of military investment. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, urged him to publish defence spending plans within the next 2 weeks. A former schools minister has told LBC the government's a little frightened of tech companies as it decides whether to ban under-16s from social media. Lord Nash is aiming to introduce such a ban by putting forward an amendment to a bill. It'll be debated later. Research suggests two-thirds of underage Australians still have access to social media, despite a ban there. But Lord Nash says it's a success.
There's been some scaremongering about the fact that there are still quite a few children on social media in Australia. They've taken down 5 million accounts. The social media companies admit that they can have highly effective age verification, and the eSafety Commission in Australia has now put the squeeze on them to do that.
A government consultation on a ban is underway. Opponents say it could push children into unregulated spaces or isolate those in minority groups. And the Health Secretary is promising faster access for conditions like endometriosis in a revised women's health strategy for England. Wes Streeting claims ditching what he calls an outdated model will also lead to fewer painful procedures and more opportunities for research. He says the NHS has an everyday sexism issue.
We should never have got to this point. I'm sorry that we have. But today is the day with this strategy that the NHS starts living up to your expectations.
In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 10 points at 10,619. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, dry with clear spells tonight for the south and east of the UK. Some rain in the north and west, lows of 6 to 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
Maria wasn't mastering the art of macaron in Paris by accident. She booked a baking class on Get Your Guide. Fate didn't have the Brooks sipping matcha with a real tea master in Tokyo. They booked that on Get Your Guide too. And luck didn't have John learning the difference between bow and stern on a Majorcan boat cruise. You guessed it, Get Your Guide. The best parts of travel don't just happen. You make them happen when you book your tours, tickets and activities on the Get Your Guide app.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, used an opportunity or took the opportunity of Prime Minister's questions in response to a question from the Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, about the war in Iran, about the relationship between the American president and the UK. Keir Starmer said he is not going to yield to pressure from President Donald Trump over that US-Israel war with Iran. He was put under a great deal of pressure also on defence spending, our own needs to defend ourselves before war, never mind during a war. This is some of what he said earlier on in the Commons.
Speaker, you will recall that on Monday, I offered to work with the Prime Minister to identify the welfare savings we need. What did he say? No thanks. Now that Lord Robertson has said, and I quote, we cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget. Yeah. Will the Prime Minister think again and work with us to find savings to fund defence?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
She was clear in what she was saying. She said we should give verbal support. I suppose that's standing on the side and saying, get in there, good luck, mate. Exactly. You've got this. Yeah. Mr Speaker, that is her approach. We are reforming welfare and spending more on defence. They did neither. The welfare bill rose by £88 billion on their watch. It soared by £33 billion under the Shadow Chancellor's watch. We're fixing it. What did they do? They voted against it. They voted to keep the broken system. So taking advice from the party opposite on reforming welfare and defence spending is like asking Liz Truss how to keep your mortgage down.
This is so poor from the Prime Minister. This is... Labour MPs are laughing, Mr Speaker. This is a moment of profound national seriousness. And what are they doing? They're promoting sex toys in Parliament. That's what they're doing. Mr Speaker, it gives a whole new meaning to fiddling while Rome burns.
Dear me, that was rather below the belt, wasn't it? Literally and metaphorically. What she's referring to there, by the way, Kemi Badenoch, is something we're going to talk about later on at 3:30, which is a Labour MP campaigning for a sex education exhibition in the House of Commons, including sex toys being present there and shown to young people, just in case you're wondering what that allusion was to. Elsewhere, on the topic of defence spending and what the government should be facing up to and helping us to face up to as a nation as well, John Foreman, a former British defence attaché to Moscow and Kyiv, and former Royal Navy officer commanding two warships, so he's kind of been there, done that. He was speaking to Nick Ferrari at breakfast, and he questioned whether a conversation about spending on defence and welfare spending will fall on deaf ears in our current government.
We underinvested in defence. We've spent on social spending rather than defence. We had two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think, you know, and I see finger-pointing in the Parliament between various, who's to blame, between various parties, they're all to blame. And I think Robertson was trying to say is that, you know, if we got ourselves in this position, this shouldn't just be a party political issue, it should be a national issue, a serious conversation about defence and what's the right balance between defending ourselves, like peace and prosperity and welfare. And I think I'm not sure whether that's actually going to work or whether it just falls on deaf ears within the current government.
Well, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, James Murray, told Nick Ferrari at breakfast the issue of defence is very much being taken seriously.
The Defence Investment Plan, Nick, is going to be a 10-year blueprint. So it's a transformation of 10 years. So yes, it's important that we learn the lessons from both Ukraine and what's happening in the Middle East and we get it right. But it's in a really important context, Nick, which is of the biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War. Now, you might remember that we came into the election with a manifesto that said that in this Parliament we would set out a path towards 2.5% of GDP being spent on defence. Because of decisions the Chancellor has taken, you know, with the Prime Minister, we're going to be hitting 2.6%, so exceeding that target, from April next year in a fully funded way. So we are making sure that money is there for defence, but it's important we spend it in the right way, which is why it's so important to get the Defence Investment Plan right.
We have to talk about the comments of a former Labour Defence Secretary, somebody you certainly will know of, you probably know well. I speak of Lord Robertson, who says, and I quote, "We cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare bill." He also speaks of a corrosive complacency with the government. How do you react?
Well, look, I've got a lot of respect